the download from Red Frog Events, Joe Reynolds, WGN Radio's Bears Beat reporter Adam Hogue, and the author of How to Speak Midwestern, Ted McClellan. Now, here's your host, a man who thinks we should take down all the statues and replace them with holograms, Justin Kaufman.
It would make it safer for protesters who climb up. I mean, there'd be nothing to climb on. I'm just thinking about everybody's safety. Then you can change it. If it falls out of style, right? If you don't like the Confederate statue, you can reprogram it. It could be a Union soldier. There's a lot of options. I'm just saying there's options. That's what I like to do, present big ideas here on the download. How's everybody doing tonight? It's Justin Kaufman. This is the download on 720 WGN Radio. I'm with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got a great show lined up. Of course we do. It's Thursday here in Chicago. Muggy, but another beautiful August day. Muggy, but beautiful. But muggy. Tonight we have some great stuff. I am over the moon that WGN Radio's Adam Hogue is joining us again tonight. We're going to talk Bears football for an hour coming up at the 9 o'clock hour. I love it when he comes in. He's one of the best in the business. We really get to brass tacks about what's going on with the quarterback situation, but also Kyle Long. Tonight, the Bears play under the lights, a little Friday night lights style. They're practicing at Prospect High School. So we will talk with Adam Hogue. He's up there right now, and he's going to come down in studio, and we will talk with him about what's going on with the Bears now that the Bourbonnais, the camp, has wrapped up and what we can expect from the team. Their second preseason game Saturday against the Arizona Cardinals. So that's coming up. Also tonight, Scott Smith's going to be here, our new media correspondent. We're going to talk about some of the issues in media. Locally, we'll talk about the Sun-Times. I think it was today's paper about the fake president. And if that editorializing is the future of the paper, or if it's a throwback to the past. I mean, it's not new. Papers have been editorializing and putting that stuff on front pages for years. Are we just paying more attention because of who owns the paper now? Scott Smith will be here. But I really want to talk to him about, you know, when it comes to everything that's happening in Charlottesville and all of the white supremacists and neo-Nazis that were involved in that, if they're not going to be condemned by the president of the United States, which he did condemn them, to be fair, he said, I condemn them. The internet and the free market seems to be taking it on, as we've seen more and more internet services from GoDaddy to Apple Pay to PayPal, OkCupid, take a stand and say we don't want this content on our sites. And what does that mean? Can they do that? I mean, when we start getting into that sticky wicket, what's next? And that's what you have to ask the question about, you know, where do we go from here? So Scott Smith's going to join us. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about how publishers continue, internet publishers, media companies continue to double down on video. But is anybody actually watching? Scott's going to join us in the 8 o'clock hour tonight. Also coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, Jeff Zimmerman's going to join us, the muralist, great muralist. I mean, you think about it, he's got murals all over town, ones that you are very aware of, whether it be the great piece along the 606, or if you have been along Lakeshore Drive at Oak Street Beach, he does all the murals there. And he just completed a work for the Year of Public Art right at 30 East Balbo down on in the South Loop. So we'll talk about that piece of work that was commissioned for the Year of Public Art. Jeff Zimmerman in studio. Also, download in Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. Tonight, Red Frog Events. Joe Reynolds in studio. This events company was inspired by Joe 10 years ago. He saw The Amazing Race on television. He said, you know what? I want to do that. Urban scavenger hunt. Let me see if I can put that together. 10 years later, he's getting $40 million in annual revenue. Think about that transition from just saying, you know what? I want to do Amazing Race.
Yeah.
Right? From he does the warrior races. He does a lot of the urban scavenger hunts. He also does the Firefly Music Festival that's in Delaware every year. And now they're getting into catering. So the company continues to expand. We'll talk about the 10-year anniversary of the Red Frog Events Company. That's coming up in the Download in Chicago Business right after the 7:30 news. And to top it all off, Pete, this is the best part. Ted McClellan's back, the author of How to Speak Midwestern, where he can tell where you're from by how you talk. Do you say soda? Do you say pop? Do you say drinking fountain or do you say bubbler? Do you say Washington or Washington? We should take that George Washington statue down. Ted McClellan coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. One of my favorite segments. We've been doing it throughout the summer, where people call up from different regions of the Midwest and we guess where you're from. That's coming up as well. So a lot to do tonight. How you doing, Pete Zimmerman?
I'm great.
Yeah.
I was in. I was just in Wisconsin, as you were,
right.
And their divvy bike program is called the Bubbler.
Oh, interesting.
It's called the Bubbler.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna take a bubbler. They're like, you're gonna drink some water? No, I'm gonna take a bubbler.
Yeah. I wonder if he knows that.
I wonder if there's confusion. Like if
an Abbott and Costello bit.
Yeah, there's an Abbott.
Somewhere in there.
We should take a bubbler. Why would I drink some bubbler from the bubbler? Not drink from the bubbler, drive the bubbler.
Yeah, there you go. I was going to say that I was also a huge Amazing Race fan, but instead of starting a great company, I would get mad that the football games would go over and my DVR wouldn't get the whole episode, so I quit watching.
Right, tomato, tomato.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same concept. Mm-hmm. I mean, that could have been you.
It could have been me, but...
You have to take on that persona.
I'm blaming Comcast for messing up the DVR. Couldn't figure out how to go through two shows.
You should start a business that's called It Could Have Been Me. And I don't know what the product is yet, but that's just what it is. I could have done that. Could have been me. See if that gets anywhere. That's kind of, I think that's all of us. We should do a new segment called The Armchair Entrepreneur. I could have done that. We never did, right? 312-981-7200 is our phone number. News, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, what we'll do, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right. This is the download on 720 WGN. Let's carry out. Okay, here are today's top stories. President Trump doubled down again, so quadrupled down on the Confederate statue issue, which is really a proxy issue for race. People wanted to make it about history, but most of the statues in question weren't built until decades after the war, Civil War. And according to the Southern Law Poverty Center, were built in the 1920s to honor the South's view of race relations, i.e. white power. So again, this isn't a fight over what Robert E. Lee stood for as a general in the Confederate Army. No, this is about why the statues were erected in the first place. So President Trump doubles down, and more of the country continues to wonder why. And more white supremacists and neo-Nazis complain about free speech and cite the president as an ally. Whew! And now we're in the midst of an intellectual argument about the difference between free speech and hate speech. Just where we want to be in 2017. If Trump really wanted to distance himself, how about an executive order on hate speech? Right? I mean, we've seen it, something akin to the Muslim travel ban or crackdown on immigration or the no transgendered in the military. Show us that you are an equal opportunity offender to and for everyone. Something tells me that's not going to happen. But because you know why? Because Trump is really, he's relishing the role of the wrestling villain, right? He's the rowdy Roddy Piper of American politics, and he just loves it. It almost feels like he holds a think tank. He's got a writer's room on every issue to see what's the most polarizing, controversial take that he could have. What if, I don't know, what if we blamed counter-protesters? Just a thought. I'm just spitballing, throwing the ball off the wall. Bravo. But what Trump won't do, the internet will. In moves that will most certainly turn into lawsuits, Apple, Spotify, OkCupid, PayPal, and other companies have blocked known white supremacists from using their services. Yee, slippery slope there. You ban white power music today, what about hip-hop that glorifies street violence tomorrow? And if Miley Cyrus continues to sing about cocaine use, is she next? Please? No. But everything that happened in Charlottesville has a chain reaction. Several cities and states are mulling whether or not to take down Confederate statues. And a local pastor here in Chicago wants Jackson and Washington Parks to be renamed because both of those presidents owned slaves. Mayor Emanuel quickly put the kibosh on that. Classic Emanuel. But I'd be down with getting rid of the Abraham Lincoln statue next to the studio, right? The one where he's talking to the regular guy. Hey, what you getting directions while they're looking at the Trump Tower? If you haven't seen it, it's a beauty. I'm just saying, we all want the Marilyn Monroe statue back. Can you bring that back? Today was Democrats' Day in Springfield, but the party canceled the outing at the fair and just stuck to the breakfast at the nearby hotel ballroom, which is really a bummer for voters because we rely on how candidates look when they try to go all casual in the summer heat. That's how I choose my who to vote for. What they're wearing on a stage at the Illinois State Fair, right? Does JB put on shorts, right? Does he roll up the sleeves? Is Bisco in socks or no socks? I need to know this. Does Chris Kennedy have the sunscreen on his nose? I need to know this. That's what matters. Speaking of weather, so muggy, so humid. If it's like this on Monday for the eclipse, I'm staying indoors. I'll just watch it on TV. Also, is North Korea attacking us? Oh, no, it's the Air and Water Show practice. All day. How have they not figured out how to make that quieter? Right? There's no scientists working on jet noise, right? They have no jet canceling headphones that we could wear. Yeah, Steve Gadlin in the frying pan. Maybe that'll be his invention tomorrow night. In sports, the Cubs hit 4 homers in an inning the first time since 2008. Then they also went back to back to back. The last time they did that was Derek Lee, Sammy Sosa, and Michael Barrett. Dream team, right? They erased a 9-0 deficit to end up losing 13-10, splitting a 4-game set at home against the Reds. The Reds are one of the worst teams in the NL who have pretty much waved a white flag. So losing 2 games to them at home is tough to stomach with the Brewers and the Cardinals right on their heels. I guess the best you can say is that the Cubbies love drama, right? I don't know. Just be too easy to win those games. Nah, better to win it all in dramatic fashion later in September, you know, when it really, really counts. They're a back-against-the-wall type squad. Also, Javi Baez may have the cockiest home run trot in baseball. So weird for a guy who hits, what, 15 homers a year, maybe? Maybe 20? I mean, when he hits a home run, it's like he's the first guy to ever do it. It's so weird. It's a regular season game against the Reds, dude. Calm down. Also, John Lester left in the second inning with a lat issue. Not enough lat issues in baseball. We'll see how that plays out moving forward. The White Sox got beat in dramatic fashion last night by the most dramatic team in baseball, the LA Dodgers. Yasiel Puig drove in 2 to win the game in the ninth inning. The Sox got another good start from Carlos Rodon and my favorite named player in baseball, Nicky Delmonico. 2 homers in that game. Dude's been on base for every single game that he's played in his major league career. How about that? 13 or 14 games. That's awesome. Nice start to a career. Trade him. Like, trade him now. Get some more prospects. The prospect monster is hungry. Yum, 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 yum. More prospects. We got to start trading our prospects for prospects. The Sox send Ronaldo Lopez to the mound tonight. The youngster is going to make his second start against the Texas Rangers. The Bears getting ready for their second preseason game against the Arizona Cardinals on Saturday. All eyes on how many reps, snaps that all the quarterbacks are going to get. I mean, I'd be okay if Mark Sanchez didn't play, right? let's get that at least, that part of the controversy out. He's gone. I mean, I say let Glennon do one drive, then give the rock to Truby. All right, the Bears are practicing tonight under the lights at Prospect High School, Mount Prospect. Nice little Friday night lights feel without the state championship feel. Instead of we're going to win it all, it's more like we're going to go 7-9. that's very positive. And I haven't seen it yet. Is Kyle Long practicing tonight? He was thrown out of practice on Tuesday, had a doctor's appointment yesterday. So what's happening with Kyle? Is he hurt? Is he frustrated? Is he missing his buddy Jay Cutler? Also, didn't realize this, but Kyle Long is from Charlottesville. I missed this rumor. But there are unofficial reports that the Bulls and Dwayne Wade are talking about a buyout of his contract so they can go play elsewhere next year. Man, the Bulls are doing everything possible this offseason to make us not watch, right? I mean, I'm not saying that D-Wade would have won any games, but exactly what do the Bulls gain by dropping him? I mean, no new players, no rebuild, just a little bit of cash. All right. So you get rid of him so a journeyman can come in on a string of 10-day contracts? Is that what we're doing? So if you're paying attention, this rumor is true. Wade, Rondo, and Jimmy Butler would not be on the Bulls anymore. What a difference a year makes. Wow. And finally tonight, a Stranger Things pop-up bar is coming to Logan Square this weekend. I don't know about you, but whenever I saw the monster from the Upside Down, I was like, man, I could go for a pizza, right? No word if Eggo waffles will be on the menu. Oh, wait. You know what? I didn't even look, and I'll bet they are. Right? Come on. That's ridiculous. Hopefully that's all that's on the menu. That's the carryout for August 17, 2017. Speaking of Stranger Things, there's some floating pieces of unidentified meat in our soup tonight. Strange, yes, but I wouldn't worry about it. It's probably tasty. All right, coming up, we're talking with Joe Reynolds, CEO of the Red Frogs Event Company. They're going to be our guests in Download in Chicago Business. At 8 o'clock, Scott Smith joins us. We'll also talk murals and Adam Hoge. Talk Bears. That's all tonight on the Download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
I am doing well. You know how we usually like to go a little light and fluffy here, you know, just getting into the news and stuff. Yeah. I want to bring up something that you said beautifully in the carryout. Okay. And that is this notion of the Googles and Facebooks of the world and the PayPals of the world.
I don't know how you do that. Yeah.
Look, we can all agree. Neo-Nazis, people who espouse these types of values, we don't have any room for them here in this country. But if you start doing what these companies are doing, as you said, this is a very slippery slope.
Yeah, I agree.
And you just, and this is, Justin, this is an issue I'm very, very passionate about. And
well, we're going to talk about it coming up at 8 o'clock with Scott.
Okay.
Because, and you can join the convo. I'm interested and I'm intrigued on what the, they can block anyone they want to. They're not a public good.
Well, you know,
the reasoning and the rationale is behind it.
Right. And what do they call it? They have, you know, when you sign up for PayPal or Google, whatever, they've got their code of conduct or whatever it is that they call it. You know, obviously nobody's going to read that 8,000 page thing that you agree to. It's scary.
It'll be interesting to see. I mean, because there may be, you know, they may be saying that hate speech and that kind of imaging or that kind of, even in the case of PayPal and Apple Pay and things, that kind of commerce they don't want on their site, just like they say they don't want pornography on their site other things. They've categorized it in a certain way. So it'll be interesting to see.
Well, and there is a difference between hate speech and violent speech.
Yeah, right. Yeah. There's a difference between a lot of speech.
Right. Well, exactly.
I'm learning something about that right now.
It's business time. It's business. It's business time.
I know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time.
Ooh, it's business. It's business time.
That's right. It's a download here on 720 WGN, and it's time for the Download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. This is our weekly segment where we talk to Chicago entrepreneurs and small business owners about their success stories. My guest tonight is the owner and co-CEO of one of the fastest growing event companies in the world. Joe Reynolds and Red Frog Events started 10 years ago producing an urban scavenger hunt. Reynolds was inspired by the show Amazing Race, and 10 years later, his love of creating events, whether it be scavenger hunts or warrior dashes, music festivals, or craft beer extravaganza, has turned Red Frog into a company with over $40 million in annual revenue. The company has added catering services to its list of products, and it continues to grow, now employing over 80 people and producing events all over the country. But Red Frog still calls Chicago home. Joe Reynolds, the owner of Red Frog, is in studio with me tonight. Joe, nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All right, so let's get into your story. I mean, I kind of mentioned it right at the top, this idea that the Amazing Race was your inspiration. Pete was joking, you know, his too, except he didn't make a event business out of it. But talk about the idea of starting this 10 years ago.
Yeah, back in 2007, I was sitting on my couch in my one-bedroom apartment in Wicker Park watching the Amazing Race and thought, hey, there might be something there. I would like to do that. So I created a one city scale down version and called it the Great Urban Race, launched one event here in Chicago in the Wicker Park neighborhood, and people showed up and a business started pretty naturally. So I did one in Chicago. I did seven more later that year and it started gaining momentum. And then in 2008, added 20 events all over the country, added a national championship in Las Vegas, and it kept moving.
At what point, I mean, I was sitting on a similar couch at a similar time watching Amazing Race. At what point did you recognize you had something with this concept? I mean, it's one thing to say, I'm going to have this fun thing in my neighborhood. And there's another to say, we have a national championship in Las Vegas.
Yeah, it was somewhere around 2008 when we were getting momentum. Each race got bigger and bigger. And then realized Red Frog could be something much larger when I launched Warrior Dash in 2009. That's an obstacle course race. People run over fire, crawl through mud, go through barbed wire, and there are 12 crazy obstacles. Launched that event in Joliet, Illinois, outside of Chicago in 2009, and that event sold out very quickly. And that's when we knew we had something really hot, and we moved very quickly, and the company started growing rapidly from
there. Let me ask you, I mean, what goes into, I mean, even in the first race to what you were just talking about with the Warrior Dash, I mean, what did you learn about the business of creating events like this? I mean, it's more than just getting people to sign up for it. There's a lot that goes into creating a race and coordinating and making sure you got to have all the ducks in a row.
Yeah, there's a lot that needs to go on the operations side of any event, and there's marketing that needs to go into it. But the way we approach it is looking backwards. We look at the customer experience and make sure that the customer has a fantastic time, that they go home, we create memories, they tell their friends and family about it, and come back. We start by looking at what that would be and work backwards and create the event off of that.
Do you rely on return customers? Is that a big part of an events-based thing? If you go to the, if you're a Warrior Dash guy and you say, I'm going to do this again and again and again, I mean, is that a big part of the business plan to make sure that they come back and do it again?
That's a key focus for all of our events. Of course, we'll lose some customers year to year, and we can gain some new ones too, but we're focused on every single person coming into any of our events having a fantastic time.
Does that change the way you approach the business at the end of the day, the product, meaning you want to make it consistent because you want to make sure that people are coming back to relive that memory? So you can't, as a CEO, you can't be like, let's change it. Let's go left to right instead of right to left. I mean, you have to keep some consistency, right?
Absolutely. We keep it consistent, but year to year, we do change. We spice it up a little bit and change little components. Like for Warrior Dash, for example, one or two obstacles will be different, new, fresh every year to make it interesting, but the core product will remain the same.
You know, it's amazing you guys are celebrating 10 years of really growing, and I mentioned the lead, the idea of going from one event in Wicker Park to $40 million in revenue. There, I mean, you caught a wave when it comes to this country's obsession with the Warrior Dashes and the obstacle courses and the amazing races. I mean, this wasn't something that was a cottage industry in the 80s or 90s. This is something that came on, and you guys are right in the center of it.
Yeah, we're fortunate. I think our timing was excellent. We started Great Urban Race in 2007, Warrior Dash in 2009, and then a big music festival called Firefly Music Festival in Dover, Delaware in 2012. The timing was great for all of those. Live entertainment continues to grow very quickly, and we're thrilled to be a part of it.
All right, Joe, I got to ask. I mean, to go from Warrior Dash to the Firefly Music Festival, that seems to be a jump, right? I mean, the idea of going to something that is really geared towards athletes and to obstacle courses and the idea of some sort of competition to a music festival that attracts alt-rock, indie rock, hip-hop, EDM. I mean, this is a major festival in Delaware every year. What brought you to make a move in that direction as opposed to stay into the world of competitive athletics?
Through our years of producing Warrior Dash events, we gained a lot of competencies. We, at its core, we knew how to put on a really good event that created great memories for people, and that translated pretty well to Firefly. The event itself, the product, putting bands on stages is different than building obstacles for people to run through. But at the end of the day, we're just creating a great experience and a great operation. It's still just an event.
And when you put an event together like a music festival, do you have to think about, I mean, do you have to go find staff that knows how to do that? Is that something, or is that something you could teach up to staff that works in other kinds of events?
Yeah, it's been a blend for us. We were new to music festivals, so we brought in a lot of skills that we had gained through Warrior Dash, but then with the skills we didn't have, say talent buying, for example, we went and found professionals.
So someone who books the bands, things like that, right? And how much are you involved in that creative pursuit? I mean, the idea is you like a band and you're like, I really want to get these guys. Can you try to get these guys? Or do you sort of, you know, do you say, okay, I'm going to let the talent buyers pick the right lineup for a festival?
We are totally focused on our customers and the bands that they want to see. We do extensive surveying every year.
Really?
And we really just listen to what they want, and we do our best to put those bands on the stage every year.
Joe Reynolds is the owner of Red Frog Events, a Chicago company that went from one race in Wicker Park to an annual revenue of $40 million plus. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. And I want to talk about how you manage that growth. You know, we'll also talk about the charitable work that you guys do and also about what's next for Red Frog Events here in the Chicago area. It's a download on Chicago Business sponsored by Signature Bank. Stay with us.
It's business time.
It's a download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank here on 720 WGN. Joe Reynolds, the owner of Red Frog Events, in studio with me tonight, talking about how he took an idea to have essentially an urban scavenger hunt, and he turned it into Red Frog, which is gets $40 million plus in annual revenue. And because it's, I mean, it's not just events anymore. I mean, you do events, you have catering, there's so many things that have rolled up in one. And it's and the biggest stat to me that's just amazing, it's only been 10 years. I mean, I talk to a lot of different people like, I'm celebrating 20 years, 25 years. What are the challenges that go into to the idea of a meteoric sort of success story? The idea of going from zero to 100 to be from sitting on your couch 10 years ago to $40 million in annual revenue.
By far, the biggest thing for us has been the rapid change that has had to come along with that. Every new event we add requires new skills to find and new great people to add onto our team. But every step of the way, there's been change for us to go from nothing to the size of company we are today.
How much emphasis do you put on culture?
A lot. I'm very proud of the fact that we offer wonderful benefits to help attract the best talent in Chicago. We offer unlimited vacation days, and we've done that for over 7 years
now. Why? I mean, why buck the trend of saying you get 3 weeks or 4 weeks off? What is it about unlimited vacation days that helps with the success at Red Frog?
Found that everybody likes different amount of vacation. Some people are people who like to work nonstop. Some like more vacation. We want to be able to attract all of those people. In my early 20s, I did a lot of world travel, and I learned that I needed time to get away and think. So I also added a sabbatical program. Every 5 years at Red Frog, you get 1 month, we pay for you to go travel somewhere, whether it's just you or with your family or whatever.
You know, for you, I'm interested because you put a lot of emphasis on culture, and you talked a lot about, you know, obviously your inspiration. How much were you an entrepreneur when you started this? I mean, was this something that you're like, I'm getting into the game, I'm going to be a business, I'm just coming up with ideas, I've been inspired? Or did you just kind of like, in the nicest way possible, kind of back into it?
I've been an entrepreneur from the beginning. I started a newspaper business in fifth grade. I started a basketball tournament company in sixth and seventh grade. In college, I started a house painting company. So it's been in my blood from day one, and I knew I always wanted to start my own business. And I absolutely love it. I love the adventure of being an entrepreneur.
The idea of starting a business and having it grow as it has for 10 years has ups and downs. I mean, you've had situations where you've acquired companies. You've had situations where you lay off people. I mean, you've lived a life in 10 years of this company. Talk about that. Talk about, as a CEO, the what you need, the strength and the leadership you need to when things are up and when things are down.
You need to stay steady so people know that when things are down, they're going to come back up, and when they're up, can't get too excited about that either, because eventually they're going to come back down. At the end of the day, I look to my people, and everything we do is about getting exactly the right people at Red Frog. And I'm so lucky to be surrounded by the most amazing group of Red Froggers I can even imagine. And when you have the right people, everything else gets a little bit easier.
You know, for you, and you talk about all these events. I mean, you talk about the first event, and then you talk about the Warrior Dashes and Joliet, and you talk about expanding that and the music festival. Is there a point where you, as the CEO, you have to decide this event has run its course, that we're not going to do this event anymore? You almost have to kill your babies. I mean, talk about the idea of letting go as a CEO when you're in a company like you are.
Yeah, letting go can be challenging. That actually happened with our first event, Great Urban Race. Ran its course in 2012. It was no longer profitable.
Is that what you look at, just the profitability? Is there other things that you would look into?
Yeah, we look at other factors. That one in particular was our first, so that was even harder. But at the end of the day, you have to do what's best for the business. Our goal is that Red Frog is around 100 plus years from now. And sometimes that includes making hard decisions like cutting off a brand like Great Urban Race.
Yeah. You know, for you guys, a lot of your story and reading it, whether it's in Forbes or on your website or other places, really centers around your charitable donations. I mean, you have a relationship with St. Jude and cancer research that isn't just about, hey, we give money to charity. I mean, it's in the first paragraph of your story. Talk about that, because to me, it feels less about, hey, we're a big company, we want to give back, and more at the core, the foundation of what you guys are trying to do.
A major part of our mission is giving back. And going back to a great urban race that happened in Denver in 2009, St. Jude came and partnered with us, and we raised a little bit of money for them. They then invited my co-CEO, Ryan Kunkel, and I to go visit the hospital in Memphis. We went, and we were blown away with the cancer research being done there for children. And I remember a very specific moment I had there when I walked into the room where children were being given anesthesia, their daily anesthesia dose. And it just hit me that I had never really thought about what it was like for a child to have cancer. And it was that moment that we decided to make a large commitment to St. Jude.
I mean, up to that point, as an entrepreneur, have you thought at all about charitable donations? I mean, what was your philosophy on it before you made this trip?
We had always given back at our early events in small ways to a wide variety of local charities, but this was different and really, really struck us. So we started donating very quickly with the Great Urban Race. We raised $175,000 the first year with our nationwide partnership with that. And then we started a program called St. Jude Warriors with our Warrior Dash event that really took off. And we have now raised, I'm proud to say, 7 years into our partnership with St. Jude, over $14 million. And we made a commitment to raise $25 million total. We're well on our way now. And just last year, we upped the ante and made a commitment to donate 1% of our profits forever to St. Jude.
And I mean, I understand the emotional attachment to that, being there to see that. And I understand the idea of wanting to give back. You know, but this seems, like I said, a little bit above it, the idea of tying what your revenues are in 1%. Is that at all a tough sell as a CEO to a board, to staff members, to people who are making money or your company to say, we're going to give 1% of our profits away?
Yeah, on the surface, it seems like a stretch, but it's built right into our mission that we're here to give back and make the world a better place. So when that's part of your mission, it's a much easier sell. And by giving the 1% of our profits to St. Jude every year, I think there are benefits too. It helps us find better talent. People are attracted to a business that goes that far. And like I said earlier, people is everything to us. Mm. So if it helps attract top talent, that's great.
You mentioned people a couple times here. My last question is about place. You guys have events all over the country. You don't have to be here in Chicago. Why is Red Frog still a Chicago company? What does it mean to be from this area?
Chicago has been wonderful to us from our very first event here in Wicker Park back in 2007. And we continue to be blown away by the level of people we can find and the talent that exists in the city. I'm so proud of my team and what we've assembled, and they're all here in Chicago. I can't imagine being anywhere else.
Joe Reynolds is the owner and co-CEO of Red Frog Events here in Chicago, as I just mentioned, a company that started with a race in 2007. 10 years later, is getting over $40 million in annual revenue. Joe, thanks so much for being my guest on the Download in Chicago Business. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Keep on that story with Rob Martyr tonight. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, what a week for speech, free or hate, and also, of course, what we do about it. This has been playing out, and we've seen it play out in the media sphere this week, especially the internet media, when we talk about places like Google, Apple, PayPal, OkCupid. Not necessarily a media company, but I guess you could say that it is. It's a lot of images and things like that on there. But what does it mean that today, and we find more and more of these companies are sort of putting a line in the sand, saying this is material. Sort of white power music comes up when we talk about Spotify, images or speech that's surrounding white supremacy or neo-Nazis. These companies, if the president is not going to step out, they will. And that's what we've seen today. Scott Smith joins us tonight. He's our new media contributor here on The Download. He's also the editorial director at Teamworks Media. Scott, good to see you, buddy.
Good to see you.
This is a fascinating conversation. We kind of talked about it right at the top about the slippery slope.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll talk about a couple other things in local media as well tonight. But this, the idea that a company like Google or Apple has a set standard of what they believe to be valuable content or I would say just content, is a head scratcher to me. And I want to hear what your thoughts are on the idea of them stepping out and saying, we're going to have this content on our sites.
Right. So this came up in two different ways this week. So the first was there's a site called Daily Stormer, which caters to neo-Nazis, and they had posted something pretty horrific about Heather Heyer, the woman who had been murdered during the demonstrations
in Charlottesville,
Charlottesville,
the woman who was run over by the car.
Correct.
Right.
And so GoDaddy had first said that they had 24 hours to find another registrar, which is the thing that sort of essentially tells the internet where to find your site, for lack of a longer way to explain it.
good explanation.
And so then they went to Google, and Google said, nope, we're not going to host you either. And right now, the site is offline. It was hosted by some kind of obscure Russian server at one point. And I understand that it's, you know, sitting on the dark web right now, for all intents and purposes, not really easily found on the internet. And then it happened again today when Spotify said that they were no longer going to carry quote-unquote white power music, or essentially music that glorifies violence against people of color, people who are gay, pretty much people of religions,
people
whether
white,
you're Jew,
right,
or Muslim,
yeah,
essentially,
yeah,
people,
yeah,
who aren't white. And so Spotify said, we're not going to carry that anymore. There is a potential intellectual slippery slope argument you can make and say, look, if these companies can do this, they could do it for any kind of content. And they are. They can. They're private companies. They could, if they don't like, let's say, social justice discussions or racial justice arguments, they could cut those off too.
Or West, traditional classic NWA West Coast violence,
right,
rap,
right,
that's about shooting people and you know, violence. I mean, you,
right,
could see them making a stand on that.
And that could happen. I feel like, though, that there's an exception for Nazis. You know, there is, it's like, yes, that's true, except Nazis. Like, we should, that's the line.
Yeah.
Like, yes, everything but Nazis, you know, they're...
And that seems to be the, as much as we chuckle a little bit in that statement, that, mm-hmm, seems to be where we're at with free speech. I mean, we're talking about it as it pertains to media,
right,
but or companies that are online. But this is a conversation that's happening all over the country right now. This concept of, yes, there is free speech, asterisk, unless you're a Nazi. And then,
right,
you get into this game of, it's really interesting because there, I think that there's merit in the idea of saying that you know, if you're going to incite this kind of rhetoric, this kind of hate speech, it is asterisked out.
Right.
You can't do that. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater.
Exactly.
You can't do this, talk this way about race.
Right. And that's the difference between this kind of speech and every other kind of speech. You know, you could argue that it is okay, or at least allowable, to have hateful speech. Ann Coulter, for example, comes to mind. Somebody who, you know, specifically says awful things about specific groups of people, but stops short of actually inciting violence against them. There is a difference between music that specifically is intended not necessarily for an artistic purpose or for a storytelling purpose, but to actually say, we're going to sing about how great it is to go out and stomp this particular group of people. And there's a difference there. It's exactly what you described as shouting fire in a crowded theater. I mean, yes, free speech, which normally just applies to government putting limits on free speech. Free speech is a value in our country. It is something that's beyond just limits the government can put on it. We value free speech when it comes to private companies as well. But most private companies are now deciding that we are not going to house speech that is an incitement to violence.
And there's a reason for it, because there's a history to it. And the history gets us to places like the Holocaust or,
right,
slavery or even what happened after slavery in the South. I mean, there's a lot of things that you can point to that are disgusting parts of human history where it started with speech like this.
And a lot of times,
I think that's why there's a differentiation when we talk about what's speech and what's hate speech.
A lot of times these arguments come up because it's something new, right? It's a new form of music. It's a new artist. It's a new what have you. This is very, very old. You know, we know how the history plays out here. We know what the next thing is that happens. And up to very recently, pretty much everybody's been on board with not Nazis.
Yeah.
And we're now all of a sudden, because we have to intellectualize and well, actually, and everything, we're now apparently doing that with incitement to violence.
The playing devil's advocate just on the idea of a private company determining what is appropriate for what site. I mean, you see heads of big media companies like Facebook or Twitter come out and condemn neo-Nazis or white supremacy. Yet that's the even with that amazing piece on Vice about that was covering the Charlottesville piece, you hear over and over, we're not just on the internet anymore. We've moved off. We've taken the meme and we've mm-hmm. gone to the streets.
Mm-hmm.
There has been a utilization of Facebook, Twitter, and other sites like this for these messages, and they haven't done anything about it. I mean, that's one thing to condemn, but it's another in practice
right.
to say, hey, we're not going to have this because they've let it go on. I mean, it's prevailed. It's a prevailing thing on both Facebook and Twitter.
Right, and both those companies have struggled with what is allowable speech. Facebook very famously has taken down posts of women discussing breastfeeding or photos of breastfeeding, for example. And so there's an example of a problematic way in which a private company is limiting a type of speech. And there's usually an uproar about it. And there's usually Facebook coming out and saying they apologize and, you know, fixing that. Twitter has been a haven for a lot of hate speech because they have not developed the kind of tools to crack down on abuse. And I think what we've seen over the last few years is when you leave speech that is an incitement to violence unchecked, it does make it easier for those folks to assemble and then to get to a point where they are actually able to take their violence offline.
Facebook and not as much Twitter, but I wonder if Facebook, it's fascinating to me because they have put more and more resources into policing their site.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
cutting down on fake news.
Oh my God! Think about even 10 years ago or 5 years ago on Facebook. You know, people wouldn't bother you. Try to put something up now that even is on the line or uses swear words, mm-hmm. and you can be monitored. So they have really upped their game, and they've put resources into being able to do that. I'm sure they've done the same at Twitter. But really, that's at the heart of, I mean, that's probably not what these media companies, these social media companies, thought they had to do at the beginning. I'm sure 5 years in, they're like, I guess we should have a budget for monitoring.
Right. I mean, there is an idea that Twitter very famously was sort of like, we are the, I think it was the free speech wing of the left wing or something to that effect. And they held themselves out as being a sort of, you know, the new a town square for a variety of ideas. And it was really easy to say that they were that when it was the Arab Spring, right? And they were sort of leading these grand revolutions, and it was how people were organizing in order to get out from under totalitarian governments. And now those same tools are being used for totalitarianism. And so there's a question many people have said, you know, why doesn't Twitter ban Donald Trump? Because here is somebody who is using this tool to inflame and to incite, maybe not exactly to incite violence, although you could make that argument when it comes to things like the video meme he created of, you know, body slamming CNN.
You could make that argument.
You could make that argument. I don't think I would go that far personally, but there is that question. It's in that there is an arguable space between is this something that is a reality or is this a satire or is this a
there's a lot joke? Of people that need to be banned before you get to the president
right
on Twitter
right
and
yeah
a lot of yeah
yeah amazingly there are worse people on Twitter than the president Smith. And it's 2017 and I'm making that statement.
Scott Smith, the editorial director at Teamworks Media, is also our new contributor here, our new media contributor here to The Download. All right, let's take a break, come back, and I want to talk about video. Another fascinating story where it was Mike, right? MIC,
mm-hmm.
Laying people off.
Yeah, 25 people.
They want to go towards video. They think video is the future, but the younger generation is like, we don't look at the videos. I mean, once again, a crisis in confidence when it comes to the digital media world that we live in. Scott Smith, my guest, stay with us. Talking media tonight here on The Download. Scott Smith is here, our media new media contributor, also the editorial director at Teamworks Media. He's also going to be a part of a panel at the City Bureau's Public Newsroom event. It's about media models for Chicago. It's on Thursday, August 31st from 6 to 8 at Build Coffee, 61st and Blackstone on the south side. Citybureau.org for more information. Scott's going to be a panel for that. Let's talk about this mic. Mic, which is, I guess, a digital newspaper.
Digital news brand, yeah. Very much in the the vein of a Slate, but for younger readers specifically, they very much fly the flag of the millennials.
They laid off 25 people.
Yeah, 25
Why?
People. Well, they say they are it is pivoting to video is the phrase.
Pivot.
Pivoting. Pivoting generally in the startup world means we had a product and we figured out that this product is not the way we're going to make as much money as we thought. And so we're going to go do a new product and it's going to be this. And so we're pivoting. It's weird to say that you're pivoting to video because video is still a kind of news product, but it's just it's a content type. It's not like you're a newspaper and you're pivoting to, I don't know, billboards or TV or something like that. Unfortunately, a lot of brands that deal with the news have been doing this. So Mashable was the first big one to have a big mass layoff. MTV followed them, Fox Sports. So there have been a whole bunch that have been doing this kind of pivot to video thing. And the idea is that they will make more money in video because CPMs, the cost that for ads, is greater for video and pre-roll or mid-roll.
So essentially, what you're telling me is that the money is in video, meaning there's more money to put an ad on the top of a video is better than a banner ad on the side of it. And that's why you're seeing more and more of these companies move to video. It's not because we necessarily want it. They just realize you can make more money off it.
Publishers are seeing that the ability for them to make money through video ads is greater than typical display, which is kind of the value of those has been killed by more and more publishers making crappy display ads. What usually happens with marketers or publishers is they come on this new content type and they're like, oh, this is great. This is amazing. We can use this to make a lot of money. And then they try to make as much of it as possible and the quality goes down. And that's case for quote unquote content. And it's the case for any kind of ad unit. What's happened with so-called native content is the same thing. People have tried to scale that out and it's by definition impossible to scale out these sort of large ad-driven articles or ad-driven video. And so now they're like, all right, well, we'll just put ads in front of all of our video. Unfortunately, I've worked for a couple different places that deal with video, and it is really hard to scale out video. It's also, you don't just put images on a video and call it a day. You still need writers. You still need editors who can say, that's a good story, that's not a good story. You still need somebody to write a script.
If I'm going to press play on a Stephen Colbert clip, I'm pressing play on a Stephen Colbert clip in the article because I know what I'm going to get. It's Stephen Colbert, and you want to be there because of the talent and the content that's there. You're not just pressing play because you opened the piece. And I think that has to come around in a way that these companies have to recognize that the media that they're producing has to be quality. Therefore, they're going to have to put some money instead of cutting people. They're going to have to put some money into it.
Right. I mean, I think we're all pretty familiar with the idea that on Monday, if you don't have HBO, you can see whatever was on John Oliver's Last Week Tonight that Monday while you're getting back into the office. Unfortunately, if a lot of publishers are just going to be doing that kind of video where they're carrying somebody else's video, there's no kind of value for them as a brand. There's nothing that makes them stick out from anybody else.
Right.
I mean, the only thing that's ever really been of value for publishers has been the data that they have on their consumers, getting their email addresses, getting subscriptions, and maybe being able to host events with them too. Video is not going to save them. It's just going to be another content type, the quality and the value of which is just going to go on the toilet.
Let's pivot and talk about the Chicago Sun-Times yesterday, or I guess it was today, right? I forget when.
I think it was yesterday.
The front page of the paper had the huge headline that said fake president, showed Donald Trump, and it was an editorial from the paper about how he kind of bungled what was happening in Charlottesville. Got a lot of attention, much more than you thought it would. Robert Feeder put it out. There were pieces about, is this the new direction under Edwin Eisendrath, the new CEO of the company? They bought it. They, all the things. Is it? I mean, is this what we're going to see? I mean, the idea that this was a much more liberal-leaning company that came in or crew that came in to buy this newspaper, is it going to be this kind of stuff, like playing off the idea of Trump and ratings?
Right. Well, what people have surmised is that because this is a group of unions that have bought the paper, that the paper is going to lean more into the idea of it being a sort of liberal bastion the way that it's traditionally been. The Tribune has been the sort of rightward counterpart of that. I think that, though, what people are missing is the idea of this newspaper kind of being independent and being locally driven and going more in that direction. You could say that, yes, they're going to be kind of left-leaning, but ultimately what people are looking for out of the Sun-Times is a punchiness. And Eisendrath, I think, has actually used that word, that the paper is punchier, that it's going to be taking stands on things. You know, if you're a reader, particularly if you're a younger reader, younger readers have often, and I say younger, I mean like 25 to 40, have said that they identify with news brands that they, as a reader, they feel like they are saying something about their identity. If they say they're a Sun-Times reader, or if they say they're a Tribune reader, or if they say they're a Mike.com reader.
It's like I listen to a certain type of music.
Right, exactly. Right. So they need for the Sun-Times to essentially feel like that the Sun-Times is speaking for them in a way. And what the Sun-Times has traditionally done with national stories is use its USA Today content and put that on the front page. I think it was a issue a couple weeks ago, and it was the Trump, the line with North Korea about fire and fury was on their front page, and it said USA Today, you know, page 29. And then there was another box, and it said, Glenn Campbell has died, go read the obituary, USA Today page, whatever it was. And so you had the entire Chicago Sun-Times front page promoting content from USA Today, which is a national
paper.
And
what we're seeing with the new move and the new owners, even quickly, is that they're making, once again, that word pivot, but they're saying that their content's going to lead. They don't necessarily need the USA Today to write about Trump. They can write about Trump.
Right. So they're going to write an editorial, or they're going to have a columnist, and they're going to tie what they're saying into a larger national story and essentially saying, look, we're a paper that understands Chicago, is looking out for the quote-unquote little guy, is looking out for what's happening locally, and we're going to speak for Chicago in that way. And that is what I think appealed to people about that.
But you can understand, the backlash. Just in the idea that, you know, a headline in a newspaper that just got bought by a liberal group says fake president.
Mm-hmm.
And a picture, I mean, it doesn't get any more, I guess, I don't want to be little d disrespectful than that, right? I mean, the idea that that's where they're going. They're going for this sort of New York Post kind of, we're going to get you. We're going to make everyone go, whoa.
Right.
And is that good? I mean, that's good, I guess.
Well, if you looked at the New York Post front page that same day, it was something, I don't forget what it was, but it was something like, I want to say sympathy for the devils or something. I think that might have been their front page.
Okay.
New York Post, very conservative leaning paper, owned by Rupert Murdoch, right? Like, so here you have the New York Post, the very right wing.
Right.
You have the Chicago Sun-Times, allegedly the very left wing. And
both
essentially
saying
both
thing.
Saying the same thing. So I don't know if there's really that argument. I think, again, it's somebody, people want a paper or a publisher who's going to not only tell the truth, but to be able to say, we're not going to do the both sides journalism or the both sides reporting. We're going to be like, this guy is bad, and he is bad. This person in your government is doing a bad thing. And that's what newspapers have always done,
and
whether it's reporting
on
corruption or columnists or editorial boards. I mean, that's essentially what the Sun-Times did here, and they got rewarded
for
it.
We're talking about it, so there you go.
Right.
The Sun-Times is getting our attention. Scott Smith is our new media contributor here at The Download, also the editorial director at Teamworks Media. He's going to be a panelist at the City Bureau's Public Newsroom event about media models for Chicago. It's coming up on Thursday, August 31st from 6 to 8 at Build Coffee at 61st and Blackstone on the south side here in Chicago. You can find out the info at citybureau.org. Scott, great to see you. Thanks for coming in, bud.
Absolutely.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Again, we'll check in with Rob Martyr. A lot of breaking news tonight, but we'll check in with Rob in just about 15 minutes or so, get an update on what's going on with the news. Well, this year has been dubbed the Year of Public Art by the city and the Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events. The city's goal is to highlight public art, the projects, and to really to help enrich the city and its neighborhoods My next guest knows a thing or two about that idea. Jeff Zimmerman is one of the best muralists in Chicago. You can see his work pretty much everywhere. Let me see. The murals along Oak Street Beach, which are wonderful. An amazing work. The Conagra mural along the 606 Trail. That's another one that's amazing. The entrance to 1871, the Merchandise Mart. His latest, a work that sprawls 16 stories on the 30 East Balbo building in the South Loop. Jeff Zimmerman got his start painting murals in Pilsen, and the Chicago artist is in studio with me tonight. Jeff, thanks for being here. Great to have you, man.
Oh, I love being here. Thanks, Justin.
It's amazing. I mean, I'm not kidding. Those are amazing pieces of work, and they're works right now that a lot of people, whether commuting on Lakeshore Drive or anywhere in downtown Chicago, are familiar with your work. What's that mean to you, that you've become sort of a fabric of Chicago?
Thank you for saying that. It's humbling, I guess. You know, if my little humble creations can speak to someone on their way to work, or you know, if someone's just looks up from texting or whatever they're doing and is struck by some color and some, you know, dynamic movement and hopefully something to think about, you know, I think I've been successful.
Right?
Yeah, that makes me happy.
How did you get started in this? Because I read something, as I just said, I mean, you got you started painting murals in Pilsen.
That's right. Yeah, I was, after I was a volunteer in South America, I got back to Chicago. I was a graphic designer. I was freelancing upstairs, as a matter of fact.
In the Trip Tower, yeah.
Yeah, and, but I was volunteering in Pilsen because I spoke Spanish, but they asked, hey, we have these at-risk teens. They want to paint a mural, and I kind of just figured it out. You make a grid. We got some paint from the
hardware store.
I love
it. I just figured it out, right.
So we did this garage, and we did this thing, and it was fine. And then a year later, the pastor of the St. Pius Church stops me and he says, hey, oh my gosh, you're that artist. I can't find anyone to paint this mural on this 5-story building of the Virgin of Guadalupe. Can you do it? And I said, sure. And but I had never painted before aside from that garage. And so I went over to Columbia College and took Painting 101 in the winter. And then in the spring, I actually called up the Chicago Public Art Group and I said, How do you paint a mural? I mean, they were so, this guy, John Pounds, he had mercy on me. And he said, well, you need scaffolding, you need primer. And I sort of just learned on the job right there. And yeah, and it was a wonderful experience and met a lot of people. And I think the people were real grateful and real happy to find themselves immortalized.
Well, I mean, you just mentioned it. I mean, as an artist, I mean, to think about the work in scale and it's easy, it's in grid, you just said. I mean, but how do you approach a 5-story piece of art? I mean, every time I see any of that, and I think I speak for a lot of anybody who's looked at murals at that size, you're like, that was an undertaking.
It's, well, I'll give up the trade secrets. I do it the same way literally that Michelangelo did the Sistine Chapel. So you do, it's just that traditional. You do everything on paper to scale in the studio. Essentially, you make a transfer. And so you kind of draw everything to scale, okay, to size, right, in the studio. You, on paper, you bring it over, you transfer it onto the wall, and then everything's in proportion. Because when you're trying to paint something, you know, 20 story or 20 feet high, but you can only back up 2 feet because you're on a swing stage scaffolding or you fall to your death, it's hard to see proportion. So so you have to make a transfer. But it's a traditional method. You know, the word cartoon comes from those transfers. So our, you know, Mickey Mouse is a cartoon. That word cartoon goes all the way back to the Sistine Chapel when Michelangelo was working on this process of transfers.
I mean, is this all you learned? You learned all this in Painting 101 at Columbia College?
No. I'm self-taught. I'm a self-taught artist. I took one painting class at Columbia College. You know, hard work and practice. And I love painting. I do it as much as I can all the time. And, but yeah, it's taken a few years here.
I've mentioned a couple. You know, I mean, amazing pieces: Oak Street Beach, 606, Merchandise Mart. But I mean, when to get to this stage where you're doing those kind of murals and you're doing a grand scale ones that are going to be seen by all of Chicago, talk about the lead up to that. I mean, you started with a garage, you did the five story. I mean, when you're in those moments where you're testing out your theories and you transfer and everything in there, I mean, I guess I would just be like, don't mess this up. Like, just like, how do you go about as an artist to make sure? I mean, you just can't make a mistake on a side of a building.
Well, you can't, right? I mean, you know, we're renting scaffolding and union guys put that up and take it down, you know, so that has to be returned. So you have to finish. And, you know, for example, here's a funny anecdote. I was we were just painting color down there in that 30 East Balbo, the real tall one.
Yeah.
It's been great weather. Mother Nature, thank you. What an awesome summer. However, it's a white wall. The sun's behind me, so I'm squinting all day long because I can't wear sunglasses. Because, for example, I tried to get away with wearing some sunglasses on that project, and I grabbed the wrong color because I couldn't see it. And I went and so we had to go back and redo it. So that's like a tragedy, right? There's not enough time. You got to take advantage of the light. You got to take advantage of the nice weather. And then you got to return all those materials that you've rented and stuff. But, you know, it begins on a napkin.
I'm amazed by it. I mean, Jeff Zimmerman's in studio tonight. We're talking about his work as a muralist here in Chicago. And really about the year of public art. And I want to get to the projects that you're working on now. You know, let's talk about the work, the 16-story work, the one that just was completed here at 30 East Balbo. Mm-hmm. That's one that is already starting to get attention because it stands out. I mean, 16 stories on the side of a building.
Yeah,
when you do that and you put a piece of art on a building like that and you are responsible for doing that and you see how the community reacts to it, what goes through your mind as an artist? I mean, do you feel like you're connected to the community or is it just a piece that you're like, on to the next thing?
Hopefully always on to the next thing. You know, we want to be busy, but you know, there's definitely a sense of, first of all, there's a sense of accomplishment because it is kind of a big project, you know, and going up there and hanging off the building with the L tracks and the L train below us. I don't know if you saw that. Gets a little hairy. Amazing, so, you know, when you pull it off and you get it done on time, there's a real good sense of accomplishment, but regular Joe and lady, you know, on the street, you know, coming up to you and or screaming up to you all the time and like maybe just doing a thumbs up. It's very gratifying. It really is. You know, I got to admit, that's some of the reason that I do it is you do feel good. And, you know, so people get, you know, they see something up there and if it's not just color and something like, wow, and how do you do that? You know, the best is when people stop for a second and go, no, you know, what? What is that? And why? What is going on? And then they use their imagination.
Yeah,
that's the real goal.
I have to say, I'm inspired by the work that you do because I think it makes the city better and the place that we live better.
Wow, thanks.
But I also would say that, I mean, it seems to be in this city, maybe it's just city alone, but there seems to be a shift from the idea of using building space, that's a brand new building, to advertise things, to put up, a billboard or something for the latest special everywhere. And instead taking that space and dedicating it to art. The same concept, it's billboard, it's painted on the side of a building, mm-hmm. but it stays there for years on end and it has more of an impact on the community around. Do you see it that way as a muralist, that you're seeing more of a trend towards that kind of work, the idea of putting art on the side of a building as opposed to the latest potato chip?
I mean, I do. I mean, you know, when I started all this, you know, it was, I don't think we even called it street art, but, you know, now it's street art, capital S, capital A. And in the olden days, you'd have to find, you know, a lot of my first works were in sort of, how do I say it, maybe marginalized neighborhoods. And people were upset.
Yeah, they were upset.
Oh, yeah. Now we seek out artwork. So it's completely gone 180 degrees. Like we seek out artwork to make our property, our neighborhood, I don't know, hip or young or vibrant or something, you know.
It's an investment. I mean, it does wonders for the neighborhood in the sense that there's art there and it attracts people and makes property values go up.
People appreciate it. I mean, people don't appreciate, you know, for example, there's that mural at Oak Street Beach. Mm-hmm. That was commissioned by the EPA, and it's really got a message, which is don't feed the seagulls. So the original idea was, so imagine it could be a billboard there. But in my opinion, people, you know, a billboard's almost invisible. Are we really reading billboards and going like, oh, that's a great idea. I'm going to go get that.
Right.
I don't. So they're not necessarily functional. So when they approached me to do their, essentially their PSA, I wasn't going to do it. But then I said, wait, I have an idea. What if we make a creative mural that people don't really get and have to sit there and kind of try and wrap their heads around it And the reason for that was people did do that, and they still do that, and they wonder what the heck is going on here. And then they find out because there's a little plaque there. So then they go seek out, I want to know what this is about.
Is it,
so message delivered and received. So that, you know, that's like a functional mural. But the public appreciates, you know, a piece of art rather than another advertisement. And that 30 East Balbo, they, you know, those guys have done a lot of Gilbane construction. They've done all sorts of projects all over the U.S.
Yeah.
They usually do sculptures. But there's a lot of muraling going on in that neighborhood. So they said, let's find someone to put up a mural here. We have this vertical, awesome opportunity.
You can make an argument that that's got more impact. You know, 16 stories of a mural as opposed to the sculpture in front of the building. I mean, it's a different. There's a different impact.
I always vote for the mural. That's me.
Jeff Zimmerman's in studio. All right, Jeff. Before I let you go, I mean, the year of public art. What's it mean to you that the city has invested in this? I mean, the idea of really sort of pushing this concept that we're doubling down on public art for you as a muralist, and you're working on a new project. I want you to tell us about it. Mm-hmm. What's it mean that the city is exploring this avenue?
I'm really happy about it. I mean, it's more that 180 degree turn. You know, the city is in favor of, you know, youngsters or me or whatever going to town and painting artwork in the public. It's crazy in a way, and it's awesome. The new commissioner of cultural affairs and special events is Mark Kelly.
Yeah, right.
And I think all of us artists are real happy when we heard that it was going to be him, because he's a big booster and sees the value in public art. So, it's a wonderful, it's like a finally some like sort of a validation. You know, I've been doing this for a long time, but now it's kind of like they've caught up to where I've always been, kind of seeing the value and the importance and how this affects people. So I guess it's like, you know, it's validation, and it's not for everyone. You know, every project that I do, there's that person. Always, every
it's
time.
So, really?
Oh, every
it's
single,
so funny. You'll like this, that we had the guys from Skidmore, Owings, and Maryland talking about the Picasso last week because they did the re-unveiling of it.
Anniversary.
And he had a folder of old letters from 1967 that the mayor at that time, Mayor Daley, just had forwarded to the design office saying, this is your project, you take the letters. And the letters are just a bunch of letters of people saying, what are you doing?
Awesome.
I can't believe it. I mean, it's just awesome history. But there are people that are still outliers. They're like, I don't want this in my neighborhood.
Every project I've done, there has been the person. It's just, you know, it's not for everybody. And, you know, and I you don't want to do lowest common denominator artwork where you're sure everyone's going to like it. You know, that this is watering it down. What's the point? So accept that some people aren't going to like it. Hopefully agitate people a little bit and get their blood going and get their imagination going too. I just had a couple days ago, this man came storming it. So I'm working down in the 10th ward for the 50x50 Year of Public Art project. And that's down in South Chicago. And it's at this place called Sky Art. Wonderful program. They've got all this community outreach and they work with kids and they try and, you know, hands-on, teach them artwork and give them, you know, they learn about creativity. But, you know, I just started painting the wall. I mean, it was primer, and we found that guy, you know, day one, this old curmudgeon.
You know, what are you doing with this wall?
He was screaming,
I like the
and
brick
shouting.
Wall.
Yeah, oh, my God. He was – but it happens every time, you know. And it's not for everyone. Most people, however, really appreciate it. And they when they see, like, a painter, they appreciate the effort. You know,
yeah,
and people, you know, it's like, excuse me, I'm dangling above these L tracks here. It's a little precarious. Give me a break.
You know? There's definitely the human being portion of murals is definitely the striking part. I think that's what we are attracted to. The idea that somebody made this as opposed to a billboard that would printed it and just sort of glued onto a space.
Well, yeah. So I'm hopefully vinyl is like I did some work in Wrigley Field. For this company, Southwater Signs, and Wrigley wants hand-painted signs. You know, it used to be vinyl. I hate vinyl. You know, they were taking my business, but it's turning around because the hand-painted is just people go up to and they go, oh, that's real.
Awesome.
The vinyl's kind of like, oh, it's a poster.
Yeah, right.
Things are looking good right now. This is a good time.
All right, good. Muralist Jeff Zimmerman in studio tonight. You can see his work all over. You can see it all over Chicago, Oak Street Beach, the 606 Trail, Merchandise Mart, now in the South Loop at the 30 East Balbo Building in the 10th Ward in South Chicago, mm-hmm. coming up here. Some of the stuff in Pilsen as well. JeffZimmerman.com if you want more information. Is that the website?
Or jazzim.com. Jeff Zimmerman, you can Google me.
Google.
Jeff Zimmerman, artist.
There you go. Jeff, thanks so much for taking some time out to talk to us tonight. I appreciate it.
This is great. Thanks for having me down.
Motoring along here on the download. Coming up, oh, so excited. Adam Hoge's going to join us. We're going to talk about the Bears. Yes, feeling good about the Bears. Trubisky. I'm a true believer. Oh, you like that one?
Oh, I
That's
like that
That's a T-shirt.
One.
True believer, but it, to keep the B on there. True believer.
Yeah.
Right?
That's it.
Nailed it.
I was thinking about it this morning. I was like, wait, that was only a week ago since all that happened?
That was last Thursday. Adam Hoge tonight. We'll do. And this is something we're going to try to do coming up in the fall. I'm so excited that to have someone like Adam of his caliber on the program to talk about the Bears and what to expect from the season, to spread out, to take calls. Let's talk about the Chicago Bears. I'm feeling something. I don't know what it is. It could have been what I had for dinner. Instead of a single, I went with a double. Maybe that's what it is. Or it could be feeling a little optimism for the Chicago Bears team. I don't know. I mean, it talked me down from the ledge, but I liked what I saw. I actually went back and watched it. Adam would be proud of me. I was like, breaking down film. I DVR'd the game, and I watched it over the weekend. I was pausing, mostly fast-forwarding, but pausing as well, different times. And, you know, I kind of had him a corner of my eye last Thursday, and we had karma.
Right, yeah.
And I was mad at myself because I said the defense. I looked over a couple times. I saw the defense giving up a play, and there was a penalty. And I was like, defense didn't do so well. And Carmen was like, well, they did all right. And I watched the game. They did great. That first team defense was fast to the ball. They seemed to really push the Denver Broncos first team offense. And I want to talk about if that truly is something that Adam sees and he's thinking about. It's could this Bears defense be what carries this team like it has in the past while we kind of work out what's happening on the offensive side of the ball with quarterbacks Glennon and Trubisky and things like that.
Yeah, I think your original prediction was 13-3. Yeah. So will talk you down from 13-3.
13. I mean, that's a conservative. I mean, I mean, it could be 14-2. I haven't looked closely.
So, Pete, what do you think? New nickname for Justin, Ron Jaworski.
Yeah, right.
Breaking down the film.
Breaking down the film. Here's what I saw. It was a pass. That's about it. All right, coming up, Adam Hoge. Stay with us. Any cooler music for this segment? As much as I love talking Bears, and I love talking Bears, this song, I don't know. Is that blasphemy for Chicago? I think it is. Pete's mad at me. So download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's time to talk Chicago Bears as we get ready for the second preseason game. You can see Arizona Cardinals coming up here on Saturday. Of course, the Chicago Bears are done with Bourbonnais, and they are now practicing up at Hallis Hall and at Prospect High School tonight in Mount Prospect. Adam Hoge was there. Adam Hoge, of course, the Bears beat reporter for WGN Radio. You can check out all his stuff at WGNradio.com/Bears and all over the air, including Saturday on the beat. Adam, how you doing, buddy? How was practice tonight?
It was fun tonight, Justin, out at Prospect High School. Got a little high school feel to the practice tonight. Wasn't that lively. They didn't even have pads on, just trying to, I think, get ready for Saturday's game. But it was a lively atmosphere. It was fun out there.
When they do this kind of practice in front of a crowd, especially really trying to capture that Friday Night Lights kind of feel, high school football feel, do they change the way they practice? Is it more scrimmage? Is it more excitement for the fans?
No, they didn't. I was kind of wondering if they would tonight maybe put the pads on and do a scrimmage like they did at Family Fest a couple of weeks ago. But no, they use this as kind of it wasn't a walkthrough, but it was a little bit more that style in that it seemed like they were just trying to get ready for Saturday. Didn't have the pads on. We're trying to just kind of execute what they're planning to do Saturday night. So it wasn't anything special. You still had the special teams periods, which are pretty boring, I think, to the fans. But, you know, I think the story with this is actually that this is a Ryan Pace creation. He did this the Saints did this in New Orleans. I don't know if it was his call, but he liked that the Saints did this, going to different high schools every year in training camp. for at least one night. So he wanted to do that here in Chicago. Last year they went to Warren High School. This year they went to Prospect, and both have been pretty successful, I think.
You know, as camp is over, which is always surprising to me, it goes so fast, and now they're at Halas Hall, do the Bears get more into a regular season mode at this point where they practice along the sort of same lines they would before a game would start on a regular season game?
So they will do that next week when that third preseason game is when they really try to execute a game we kind of simulate that routine the entire week. Right now, you know, this has been anything but a game week. They were in Bourbonnais on Monday. They took Tuesday off. They were at Halas Hall yesterday. Now they're at a high school tonight. They'll travel tomorrow. It's been kind of a crazy week all over the place. So next week, though, the nice thing is that the last 2 years, the Bears have had this third preseason game on Sunday, and it's been a noon kickoff. So it's been very similar to a regular season game in that regard. And so they'll come home on Sunday. They'll reconvene at Halas Hall Monday, which is pretty usual mm-hmm. in the game week. Tuesday will be the regular off day that the NFL usually have on Tuesdays during the season. And then they'll come back Wednesday, practice, Thursday practice, Friday practice. Saturday is always kind of a walkthrough. And then Sunday will be the game. So they'll be able to really simulate this next week as they get ready for the Titans, and that of course will be the game that the starters play the most.
Okay, so let me ask just about, you know, as we get to the second preseason game, has it changed at all under John Fox and Ryan Pace the way that this team approaches the preseason? Usually there's a traditional kind of way that they only play the starters play what is a couple series in the first game, a couple more in the second, and it's a third game that you see them play a whole half or more than a half. Is that what we can expect from this weekend, that they're just going to kind of take it easy, sort of half throttle?
Yeah. Well, to answer the first part of your question, I haven't really noticed anything too drastically different in that regard. John Fox has been in this league for a long time, and he's kind of done what I would say the majority of head coaches do, which is, you know, the first game, starters play just a couple series. Second game, it's pretty common for them to play the entire first half. And that's what we've seen the last couple years, both in Indianapolis 2 years ago in the second preseason game and then last year in New England. So I would think Mike Glennon plays a lot more than he did last week. I think Saturday in Arizona you'll see a lot more of Mike Glennon deep into the second quarter, if not the entire first half. And then in the third preseason game, we'll see how they adjust because, and I'm sure we're going to get into this conversation, I mean, I think you might have to tweak things a little bit, do things a lot different in that third preseason game if we see the second game play out how last week did against the Broncos.
All right, so let's do this. 312-981-7200. We also got some people lining up. Want to talk about the quarterbacks. Let's do this. Let's take a quick break so we stay on time tonight. We'll come back and we'll start the second part of our conversation about the quarterbacks, Mike Glennon, Mitchell Trubisky, how they did tonight and what we can expect in game two in Arizona on Saturday. Adam Hogue with us, WGN Radio Sports, covers the Bears, the beat reporter for WGN Radio. Stay with us.
Chicago Bears, all around the city we come to make a run. The Bears, the Bears.
Zim comes through from our updated Bears song. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Justin Kopp and Adam Hogue on the line as well, as Adam was at Prospect High School tonight for the nighttime practice, and of course we're covering the Bears here. Bears beat reporter for WGN Radio. You can find out all the stuff he does. Great stuff. WGNradio.com/Bears. All right. So Adam, why don't we get to the phones? I think that Nicholas speaks for all of us. Nicholas, why don't you start us off with the question of the night?
Hi, Adam. Obviously, you tweeted out that Mike Glennon has a big completions today. What were your takeaways from him? And of course, how does Chicago's favorite quarterback do, Mitch Trubisky?
Thanks, Nicholas.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's a big game Saturday for Mike Glennon. No question. After he posted 0.0 passer rating, I think the Bears are encouraged with how he bounced back in practice this week. And I would say the biggest improvement I personally saw was the connection on deeper passes downfield, which up until this week in practice had been really hard to come by. In fact, Dow Loggins, in his only media appearance of the entire preseason with us, mentioned that as, hey, we got to start completing these deep balls. And it was really a question about Mike Glennon and an answer about Mike Glennon. So he came back this week. Today he had a nice, I think what Nicholas was referring to is a tweet from practice today, where he had four straight throws. He hit Zach Miller downfield, Cam Meredith downfield, Kevin White downfield, and then Kevin White again downfield. Some big chunk plays. So that was encouraging to see from Mike Glennon. Now, I'd still say that he tends to struggle under pressure. And that's going to be something that I continue to watch going forward in the preseason, because it was all over his Tampa tape, too. When they protected him well in Tampa, he looked like a good NFL quarterback. Not just a starter level, but a good quarterback. His struggles came when all of a sudden that pocket got a little muddy, meaning he's under pressure and guys are around his feet. He doesn't have the same footwork as Mitch Trubisky. He doesn't have the same athleticism. And also part of that, it's not just physical ability. The other half of it is just instinct. Some quarterbacks, the great quarterbacks, have the feel in the pocket. They can just sort of sense the pressure, and they have that timer in their head that goes off. And I think that's something that Jay Cutler always struggled with, that timer in his head. And one of the things I love about Mitch Trubisky's college tape was that ability. I think that's something Ryan Pace saw on the tape, and that's just something you can't teach. We saw it a little bit in that first preseason game. I continue to see that in practice. So in terms of Trubisky, at least today, his accuracy was off a little bit, but I still saw a great throw when Vic Fangio sent a blitz from the left side. He got rid of the ball right away, so quickly that when Daniel Braverman turned around, the ball was already in his hands. I don't think he ever saw it. And that's the kind of stuff you love to see from a rookie quarterback.
Well, you know, I remember from draft night when you talked about Trubisky and you talked about what he could do, especially just looking at the tape from the bowl game, that he thrived under pressure. It seemed like he stepped up his game when backs were against the wall. So, yeah, that contrast is going to play out if that's the case, if Mike Glennon can't do that.
Yeah, and I mean, let's not downplay it. This is a preseason game, sure, but Mike Glennon, this is maybe the biggest start in his career. I mean, because he has to bounce back and play better. There's no question that the pressure is building. And let's just kind of play this out. I mean, I expect Glennon to play better, but if he doesn't, and Mitch Trubisky plays better, or at least the same, or you know, better than Glennon, I don't know how they can look the players in that locker room in the eye and say that Glennon's unquestionably the starter. So in that scenario, I would think you'd have to go into the third preseason game and I maybe still start Glennon, but switch series, give Trubisky a chance. They just don't seem to want to do that at all, because I asked John Fox tonight if the plan was to use the same order with the quarterback Saturday. And he said, I've been asked that 20 times, yes. And it's like, well, no, you have not been asked that this week. And it wasn't so much about Glennon. He's obviously starting. The question was really about Mark Sanchez.
Yeah, we don't want to see Mark Sanchez.
I don't understand why Sanchez even plays Saturday.
Yeah.
There's no
We know
point.
What we get out of him, right? You talked about in the podcast, too. Like, there's fans, everyone knows what we get out of Mark Sanchez. He's in a perfect position. He doesn't need the reps. We want to see what Trubisky can do. And, of course, or give the time to Mike Glennon, because he needs reps as well.
Yeah, they both do. I mean, it's not just about Trubisky. Glennon, I think you saw in that game, and I said going into that first game, he needs reps. I thought he should have played more than he did. But, yeah, Mark Sanchez has started 72 NFL games. Okay, nothing that happened Saturday night is going to have any impact on how well he plays this year or doesn't play if he gets into a game. Mark Sanchez is what he is. He can use practice time to get used to his receivers and understand the offense, which he already does. I put this in my 10 Bears Things column as a little nugget. He was actually calling plays in practice Monday when he was sitting out with a minor ankle injury. He was calling the plays. So he understands the offense.
Yeah, he is adjusted, yeah.
I would give Glennon the entire first half. I would give Trubisky the entire second half, and that's it. But that doesn't sound like that's what they're going to do.
Well, you know, let's stay on the offense, because we can do the defense in the second half, because I'm really high on the defense. You'll be happy to hear, Adam, that I did some tape study myself to get ready for this. A lot of fast forwards, but still. But with the offense, I mean, one thing to be said about Mike Glennon, you've talked about this as well, is that it wasn't just him. The first team offense against the Denver Broncos defense in the first preseason game did not play well. The receivers didn't make any separation. They dropped. I mean, the first pass that was attempted was dropped by Cam Meredith. You had this sense that the offensive line, there was a lot of pressure. I mean, didn't Mike Glennon get hit in the jaw? I mean, it wasn't necessarily a great outing to put all of the struggles just on Mike Glennon. Maybe a bit unfair because the whole first team didn't do so well.
Yeah, actually, that's a good observation with him getting hit in the jaw. That technically, by rule, should have been a roughing the passer on his pick six, and it should have come back. I didn't notice that until I went back and watched the tape, too, so I'm not surprised the referees missed it. But it's a good point, and John Fox was quick to point that out in his press conferences. Ryan Pace was also very clear and quick to point that out in his, when we had him on our podcast earlier in the week. And sure, that's part of them. You know, they want to protect Glennon. They don't want to put all the pressure on him, and they want to defend him a little bit. Of course, that's part of it. But it was also true. I mean, the left side of his offensive line did not play well when Glennon was out there. They both his left tackle and Charles Leno and his left guard and Tom Compton gave up pressure on that pick six. I still think he made the wrong read and should have thrown it underneath.
Yeah, right.
And that speaks to what I was just talking about, too. When pressure comes, he doesn't always make the right decision. And so that's something to continue to watch. But he also, Zach Miller dropped a ball on him, and Cam Meredith had one in his hands that the defensive back came in and hit him, and it was well timed, and the ball came out. You want your starting wide receivers to hold on to that football too, though. So he could have gotten more help. But I always look at it like this too, and quarterbacks, the great quarterbacks, lift up the rest of the players on the field, and they manage to make plays even when, you know, not all the rest of the 10 guys are all doing their jobs 100% correctly. And we saw a big difference when Mitch Trubisky went in the game. Because it's not like all 10 guys were perfect on every single play. Trubisky wasn't even perfect. He told us that.
Yeah. Before we go to the news, before we hit the break, one last question. I'm surprised that Cam Meredith shows up as the number one receiver for the Bears. Is that due to injury? Is that due to Marcus Wheaton not being in the game? Is that due to the ineffectiveness of Kevin White? Is Cam Meredith really lined up as the number one receiver on this Bears offense?
Well, he sure seems like Mike Glennon's number one option right now. It's an interesting way to ask the question because I think in an ideal world, Justin, that they want Kevin White to be the number one guy, right? I mean, he's the number seven overall pick a couple of years ago. And so I think they looked at this like, okay, well, Kevin White can still be that guy, and Cam Meredith looked like he can be a pretty good number two, but Kevin White's not doing that right now. I mean, he's been mostly invisible in training camp. He didn't even get a target in the first preseason game. So I think Cam's a good NFL wide receiver. I think ideally he's a number two on a good football team. Mm-hmm. Right now he's the Bears' number one, partly because he's earned it, and he looks good, and he's developed, I think, a nice relationship with Mike Glennon so far. But I also think part of it is that Glennon and Kevin White, we haven't seen it on the field yet in terms of that relationship. And I actually, you know, I would almost like to see Kevin White get some time with Mitch Trubisky just to see if anything's different there. Because right now in practice, it's been he's been playing almost exclusively with Glennon, and it's concerning to me that Kevin White's not doing more right now.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see too, putting some of those receivers with Trubisky as well. Adam Hogue, of course, WGN Radio Sports Bears beat reporting. Check out all this stuff at wgnradio.com/bears. All over the dial, covering the Bears this season for WGN Radio. All right, let's take a break. We'll get the update from Rob, and then we come back. I got Mustafa on the line. I got Dave on the line. I've got a bunch of texts that are in. We'll get to everybody. Adam's with us through the 9 o'clock hour, so stay with us. You know, I ask and I shall receive. Thanks, Pete. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. On the line with us, Adam Hogue, WGN Radio Sports Bears beat reporter. Of course, covering the Bears tonight over at Prospect High School, Mount Prospect, for their nighttime practice. And getting us ready for the second preseason game against the Arizona Cardinals. You can, of course, see all of Adam's coverage on Twitter, Adam Hogue, or, of course, WGN Radio.com/Bears. Adam, before we get to the defense, which I really want to talk about, Let's get to some of the texts and callers, but let's just do text. Where are you at with Charles Leno? 847 wants to know about Charles Leno, who didn't have a great first preseason game. A lot riding on him being a solid left tackle.
Yeah, and I think that the Bears made it very clear that they want to see more from him before they give him a whole bunch of money, because he is in a contract year, and I talked to him early on in training camp, and he made it very clear that he's motivated by the fact that he was not given a contract extension going into the last year of his rookie deal. So he knows what's on the line. I was still kind of optimistic that he'll have some good results. They want to see more consistency. It's not like he's a bad left tackle, but they just want more consistency from him before they give him a boatload of money. But he can make a lot of money this year if he plays at a high level, whether it's here in Chicago or elsewhere.
Somewhere else, right.
I was a little surprised that he struggled the way he did in that first preseason game. But, you know, it's one game, and we'll see how he rebounds on Saturday.
Let's stay right there on the offensive line. Kyle Long was at practice tonight after missing yesterday with a doctor's appointment and the day before getting thrown out for fighting. Now, a strange, frustrating week for Kyle Long, who arguably is the Bears' superstar. I mean, he's the guy who's on the billboards on the Kennedy. I mean, he's sort of the go-to marketable guy on this squad. A tough week.
Yeah, which, by the way, nothing against Kyle. Kyle should be the face of the franchise right now. But typically, you don't want your left guard as the face of the franchise. So
typically, right.
I think the Bears are hoping that, you know, somebody like Mitch Trubisky can come along, or Jordan Howard can end up, you know, being the guy that's selling all the jerseys. But you're absolutely right about that right now. And it's an interesting situation. Some of us were skeptical that it actually was a doctor's appointment yesterday, considering he was kicked out of practice Monday. But based on what John Fox told us tonight at Prospect High School, it does sound like there was an appointment yesterday. He said it was something that was scheduled a week ago, and they did some kind of treatment. He didn't go into specifics, but some kind of treatment that requires you to be to not practice for 24 hours, which was at least an excuse for why he wasn't practicing tonight, because that did kind of seem like a setback, right? Because at least he was practicing Monday, so he was there today, but he wasn't out there actually practicing. So that's what they're saying right now. He also, I noticed, had a brace on his right ankle, which was new. At least I didn't remember seeing that in Bourbonnais. So look, I think it's time to, I don't want to say worry about Kyle, but certainly keep an eye on him. He seemed to be making strides early in the week until this whole thing went down. And now I think it's pretty clear that the ankle is still an issue for him. He's frustrated by it, and it appears to be both a physical and mental issue with him. Mm-hmm. And I pointed this out before, and I believe it. Ideally, you want to get Kyle out there in one of these last three preseason games. It's not going to happen Saturday. So one of the last two preseason games, to get him some reps out there in live action at left guard, because he's making a position switch. And by his own admission, when we talked to him on Sunday, it's a drastic change for him.
Yeah.
So if you throw him out there week one against the Falcons, and that's the first time he's playing the position, that's a little concerning to me.
And, you know, we said it all along in the last couple of years with Jay Cutler having to adjust to new systems every it seemed like every year with different offensive coordinators. Kyle Long has had a career in Chicago where they haven't figured out what to do with him. I mean, he bumped from one position to another, back to this one. Now he's trying a whole new thing. I mean, he is definitely a guy who has had a lot of changes in his early career here in Chicago.
Yeah, and I haven't been able to get a good reason for why they're making a switch from right guard to left guard other than that shoulder, which to me is a good reason. Now, remember, the shoulder, it's his left shoulder that's the issue, and when you play guard, you take most of the force on your inside shoulder, so the shoulder that's closest to the center next to you. So when he's at right guard, it is that left shoulder that he does have the torn labrum that he's playing with that would have, you know, been exposed the most. So that, to me, has been relayed as the biggest reason why they're moving him to the left side, so it helps out that shoulder a little bit, and I understand that. But I sure hope that actually is the reason, because otherwise I don't really understand why you're messing with him while he's also recovering from this ankle injury and he can't practice that much. But obviously, they think it's going to help him. They don't have any concerns about Josh Sitton moving back to the right side where he played for a long time for the Packers. I just look, you got to find some continuity here. And while Kyle Long is out, I'll give you something to watch. What do they do with the offensive line that's missing Kyle? Do they have Hronis Grassou play center and kick Cody Whitehair
back to
guard? And remember, Whitehair looked like, I mean, he was going to be playing center for a long time for the Bears. But if Grassou can only play there, then you might have to do that. Or do they try to give Grassou some reps at guard this weekend? I'm very interested to see how that plays
out.
That's
good to monitor, yeah. Let's switch to the defensive side of the ball. This is an area that, of course, high expectations for this squad, just based on the fact that it's the Chicago Bears, and we expect a defensive unit. I've had Mustafa on the line for a while. He's got a question about the defense. Why don't I bring him in now? Mustafa, what's your question?
Hi, I had a question about the Bears secondary. I haven't heard much about Marcus Cooper since the beginning of training camp, and I was just wondering if that was related to Kyle Fuller's performance at all.
All right, there you go. Thanks, Mustafa. Let's start with the secondary. That's a big storyline, and he's talking about Marcus Cooper, the corner, and, of course, Kyle Fuller as well.
Yeah, and the reason why you haven't heard a whole lot about Marcus Cooper is because he's been limited in practice a lot because of a hamstring issue. So, and that goes back to OTAs, and he was very limited early in camp. So I still look at Prince Amukamara and Marcus Cooper as your starters, but now Amukamara has a hamstring issue that started on Monday, and I'm not sure he's going to play this weekend. I think Cooper might, but meanwhile Bryce Callahan's also out. So you got a lot of injuries right now that are going on with your cornerbacks, and Kyle Fuller was actually dealing with a calf early on in camp too. He's since returned and has been able to string a lot of practices together. But since the caller mentioned Kyle Fuller, I'll just say this. I think it's a big game for him Saturday. I think he's going to get the opportunity with Amukamara out. He's going to probably start the game, and he's probably going to play a lot, and he's going to be facing the Cardinals starters. Now, I don't know what the Cardinals are planning to do, if Larry Fitzgerald's going to play or not. Personally, I wouldn't play him. But they still have some good receivers in Arizona, and he's going to be tested. So I would say it's a big game for Kyle Fuller. In the meantime, if everybody's healthy, I would still say that Marcus Cooper and Prince Amukamara are your starters, and that does put Kyle Fuller in danger because he doesn't do a whole lot on special teams. But I think since we're already seeing some of these injuries, Kyle Fuller's not a bad backup to have.
Yeah, absolutely.
As long as he proves that in this game Saturday and going forward, it still should secure his spot on this roster, I believe.
Well, let's keep it in the secondary. The safety play was somewhat impressive. I mean, you saw good play from Quentin Demps, who's the veteran who came in from Houston. But we also saw something in the second team from Eddie Jackson, playing with number 39, seemed to be around the ball a little bit in the second string defense against the Broncos. What do we make of the safety situation as it plays out for Saturday?
Well, I always like to talk about first impressions in training camp. And Eddie Jackson, from the first day he got out there, once he got healthy, because remember, he didn't do much in OTAs. But once he got out there, pads were on and everything, right away I saw him make a play on the ball. And I go, wouldn't surprise me if he's starting week one.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, the other Quentin Demps is brought here because he can't make plays on the ball. But his spot is secure. I'm talking about the free safety spot. We're talking about Adrian Amos, Harold Jones-Quarte, Deion Bush, a draft pick last year. And those are the guys that are competing there with Eddie Jackson. And to me, having seen all those other guys play a lot of games in the Bears uniform and not make a lot of plays on the ball, what Eddie Jackson's already done tells me that he might be the best option. I'm curious to see if he gets some time with the ones on Saturday. I would highly recommend he get some time with the ones. It's something they've done in practice. It's kind of switching him and Adrian Amos a little bit. And let's see how he continues to perform, because I like what I've seen from him. He is a tall safety. He has long arms. He seems to track the ball really well in the air. And I think that is, as long as that leg is healthy, and so far that has not looked to be an issue at all. Remember, he broke his leg at Alabama last year. I think he's probably the best option at the free safety position.
All right, we saved the best for last in our last 10 minutes here. 312-981-7200. We're talking about the front seven for the Chicago Bears defense. I thought, Adam, just watching the tape in the, of the first team, and even some of the second team guys, that they know that they're the strength of the team, and they're out to prove it. There's something about the way that the tackles, Akeem Hicks and even Eddie Goldman, as well as the linebackers playing, that seemed to grab my attention, that they played fast to the ball, and they played with a little bit of intensity.
Yeah, I would say that's accurate. I think that there's two players in particular, two young players, that could really dictate the fate of this defense this year in the front seven. And that's Eddie Goldman, who at times looks absolutely unstoppable at nose tackle. And boy, do they need him to stay healthy, because he completely changes the run defense and also brings some pass rush ability in that spot, and really just makes it so much easier when he can eat up the space he eats in the middle of that defensive line to get Akeem Hicks free, to get Mitch Unrein free, who had a really good preseason opener. And by the way, Unrein suffered a concussion yesterday, did not practice today. So I'm not sure you'll see him on Saturday.
Practice concussions, never good.
Yeah, you don't like that. But, right. I mean, that's what – hey, not to get sidetracked, but everyone talks about concussions – the concussion issue in the NFL, what people don't realize is there's a lot of banging of the heads in practice between offensive and defensive linemen, and that adds up over time.
Oh,
and that's what people don't think about. So anyway, to get back to what I was saying, Eddie Goldman and the other one being Leonard Floyd. And you saw Leonard Floyd come off the edge on the first play the other night, last week against the Broncos, and just say, wow. And that's what they need. So Eddie Goldman and Leonard Floyd, boy, they could really make the difference on this Bears defense, I think. And you're right. I think if they're healthy, and they got to get Danny Trevathan back. He's slowly adding more responsibilities every day in practice. They get him back with Jarrell Freeman. I think it's a pretty good front seven. And I think this is a defense that feels like they're not getting talked about enough. And they are playing with a chip on their shoulder, and should be improved if that health is there. And I'm just starting to get a little worried, because you're starting to see these guys get dinged up here and there. And I know it's football and it happens, but you just want to avoid the catastrophic injuries.
Yeah, and last year we saw how that played out. Not only does it hurt the team, but it hurts your interest in the game. I mean, towards November, it was, you know, it felt like I was watching the 87 scab teams. Half the guys that were in there in the secondary, I was like, I've never heard of these guys.
It got ugly.
Leonard Floyd, you know, kind of mentioned there. I mean, he came off the block in that preseason game, and he got a sack right away on the corner. He brings an explosive. He had a great preseason, much different than he had last year when he was a rookie, and he's already getting hurt when he started. Couldn't even stay on the field. Mm-hmm. I mean, does he see himself as a bona fide NFL star? Does he have the swagger that he's approaching this NFL season with the fact that he could be a defensive player, if not maybe player of the year?
Well, it's an interesting question, because he's really a quiet kid. You know, he doesn't he's very polite when he talks to us. Everybody's sir. You know, he doesn't kind of have that pizzazz when he's just sort of talking to himself, talking to us and kind of marketing himself through the media. But on the field, he sure is exciting to watch. And so I think ultimately, if he comes out, and I predicted before training camp that he could be a Pro Bowler this year. Mm-hmm. And I think he has that ability. Because, look, he had 7 sacks last year, despite the fact that I didn't really ever feel like he was completely ready for the NFL. He needed to put on weight. He had to get stronger. He clearly was not ready for the rigors of the NFL, which is why those nagging injuries kept coming. And you knew if he could make that jump in the offseason, and people forget, when kids come in from college, they spend a lot of that time before the draft, which is basically training for a track meet, not football. And then they get thrown into to a much harder level competition, and they're expected to be ready to go out there and battle and training camp with pads on right away. And it's not a surprise when guys get hurt right away. So the Bears made a conscious effort this year with their rookies to spend extra time with them. They stayed longer after OTAs. They came back earlier before training camp started, because I think they learned their lesson with Leonard Floyd last year. But with Floyd, he has looked like a different player. He looks stronger. He looks like he's going to hold up better. It's very encouraging that he's been out there in every single practice since camp opened. And I don't think anybody's questioning the ability. And if he gets out there and plays 16 games, I think double-digit sacks is a slam dunk no-brainer. I think that'll just definitely happen because of his talent level. And I think he can get even higher to the Pro Bowl-type level.
You know, on the other side, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned Mitch Unrein with the concussion because he's in a little bit of a camp competition because Jonathan Bullard, the second-round pick, third-round pick from Florida last year, who we had a lot of expectations for, didn't see him on the field much at all last year. He had a tremendous game. He was around the ball the entire time. He showed something that we hadn't seen. I mean, does that performance and his performance in camp and practice, are we looking at a chance that Jonathan Bullard could be a starter on this line?
Well, I think they would certainly like him to push Mitch Unrein. Now, remember, Mitch Unrein is a John Fox guy. He played with him in Denver, and he's just a steady, reliable type player who I don't think is any danger on the roster, but certainly you'd love if your third-round pick from last year can push him for the starting job. I think that just shows you maybe that some of the depth that the Bears have on the defensive line that maybe they didn't have last year. Now, Bullard's an interesting case, and I'll probably admit that I probably wrote him off too easily this offseason because I loved him coming out of Florida. I thought that he would contribute more than he did as a rookie. And he had I remember going back and looking at some of the things I wrote last year, and he had a decent camp. And then he just sort of disappeared when the regular season started. And to the point where I was like, he must really be in the doghouse. And what I – talking to Jay Rogers, the Bears defensive line coach, a couple weeks ago, he really explained it to me perfectly. The thing was, he came from a 4-3 defense in Florida, which was really more of the Lovie Smith style. Think about Henry Melton shooting right up the gap and getting after the quarterback on every play. So Bullard was switching to a 3-4 where they were asking him to use completely different techniques. Without getting too football-y, he just didn't have the experience to do what he was being asked to do in Vic Fangio's defense. And I think that's why he struggled in the regular season. So he got bigger. Same type of deal with Leonard Floyd, although I think a lot of it, too, is just had to get used to a new defense. And so far, he looks capable in this defense this year. And I don't think anybody's questioning the get-off and the ability on the defensive line. He has some talent and some quickness. So I think that's somebody that they like what they've seen so far.
Well, we've gone this whole hour without talking about Roberto Aguayo. Did I say that right? Aguayo. Aguayo.
Yeah.
But who should we be looking at in this game on Saturday? You know, as we look closer at as we get closer and closer to cut downs and the idea that some of these bubble players may not be on the squad when the season kicks off in September, who should we be looking at? I mean, who's got to prove some stuff on Saturday?
Are you talking about beyond just the kickers?
Yeah, beyond the kickers. Yeah.
Yeah. I was looking at, I was a little distracted because I was looking up. I saw earlier that Nick Folk, who they basically chose over Aguayo down in Tampa.
He had a tough night tonight.
Yeah, he missed a 47-yard field goal and had his first one blocked. So they're I don't know what they're doing out in Tampa, but they're struggling with their kick.
You'll like this, Adam. I was watching Hard Knocks on tape the other night.
Yeah.
I was out of town. I was in Wisconsin, so I missed that we picked up that kicker. And I watched the whole storyline of him getting cut. And then in the end, when they do the credits, they go, the Chicago Bears have claimed. And I'm like, I didn't even know that. All right. Well, there you go.
That's good news for you. So I think the guys that I've really singled out in this game start with Kevin White, Kyle Fuller, obviously Mike Glennon. And I also look at Hronis Gersou as somebody that needs to have a big game. But at this point, you asked me kind of who's on the bubble, and those are four guys who I think are going to make it. It's just they need to
show something.
Continue to show something. I'll give you one guy that I didn't think was on the bubble 2 weeks ago that might be because of injury and a deep competition. And that's Jeremy Lankford, who this time last year
was a starter,
was the Bears' starting running back.
Wow.
And he sprains his ankle last year. He missed 4 or 5 games, came back, but then had lost his job to Jordan Howard and ended up obviously wasn't at 100%. He had surgery on that ankle in the offseason. So he comes back, supposedly everything's fine, and on the first day of training camp, he re-sprains the ankle, not as bad, but can't come back until yesterday. And practiced a lot yesterday, and then tonight he wasn't really out there. So I don't know if he's going to be able to play Saturday, but that is a guy that needs to prove himself, because with the addition of Tariq Cohen, Kadeem Carey, I thought, looked great in the first game, and Benny Cunningham is a veteran who you can rely on. This is a deep running back group. Yeah. And I still think Lankford's probably the best option at this point to be the true backup to Jordan Howard, but at some point, you got to show it on the field. So that's somebody I'm watching closely over the next few games.
Well, we'll be watching Adam Hoge's feed closely as he continues to cover the Bears. You can get him at Adam Hoge on Twitter. Also, of course, at WGNRadio.com/Bears on the beat on Saturdays. And, of course, his podcast with Adam Johns. Adam, great stuff. And we'll continue to watch. And I'm going to do some film study on Saturday night and make sure that I'm ready for the next time we talk. It's going to be a lot of X's and O's.
It's a late one on Saturday night, 9 p.m. start, but I'll be there in Arizona. I'll have all the Twitter updates as always, and it'll be a fun preseason game.
All right, Adam Hoge, thanks, buddy.
Thanks, Justin.
Thanks, Rob. It is the download here on 720 WGN, and I've been waiting for this segment since the last time we did it, which was about a month ago. Ted McClellan back in studio, the author of the book, How to Speak Midwestern. In the book, Ted McClellan not only breaks down the elusive regional accents of the Midwest, but he also creates the ultimate glossary of terms used in the area, in our area. Phrases like hodag, or overdare, or farty, which, again, my favorite way that people in St. Louis say 40. So here's a game. We're playing for Lou Malnati's Pizza as we do. Let's stump Ted. You could call in. You could text in. We're going to guess your regional accents through interrogation, of course. And also tonight we'll talk about the Chicago accent.
Yes,
the Chicago accent.
Chicago accent contest.
Chicago accent off.
Yes, an accent off.
An accent off.
A pizza for the best Chicago accent.
A pizza for the best Chicago accent.
And we're going to play who I think has the best accent in Chicago, Alderman Spezzato. He's gonna sort of set the standard.
He'll set it up.
You have to beat.
Ted McClellan in studio. He's going to be at the Skokie Public Library coming up on the 22nd. That's 7 Tuesday,
o'clock.
7 o'clock. Good to see you, Ted. How are you, bud?
Great. Great to be back in Chicago after...
Well, you were way up north. So you're way up north.
Way outside the north central zone in Fargo country.
What did you... I mean, when you
they
go
really
there...
talk like that.
Do you go and do you sort of seek out as real as you can get to sort of, you know?
Yeah, I was drinking Northeast beers with, you know, women from Brainerd, Minnesota after an event and, you know, soaking in the true nasality of the Minnesota accent. And I was on the, what was it? I was in Hibbing, Minnesota, Bob Dylan's hometown. And I think I don't remember what I was drinking, but I was drinking with a retired taconite miner who kept saying, you know, ending every sentence with A. So it's like the UP up there, you know, sort of the same ethnic mix. People came to work in the mines and, you know, sort of developed this pigeon almost.
That's so interesting. 312-981-7200 is funny because I was I had a segment for a couple thriller writers. One was from Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah.
And she came in and I spent the first 2 minutes going, what do you call the space between the sidewalk and the street?
And in Columbus, they don't really call it anything.
That's where she goes, I don't know what to call that.
Yeah,
I was like,
no, that's Cleveland. In Cleveland, they call it a tree lawn.
Oh, that's
and in Akron, it's a devil strip.
Yeah, that's...
Yes.
I kept going, you're not from Ohio.
Yeah, no.
You don't know what's happening.
Columbus is like the blandest of the bland, you know. Ask her, you know, what about that little candy with the, you know, the peanut butter and chocolate? She'd know that one.
She'd know that, right?
The Buckeye.
Buckeye, right.
Yeah,
right.
And ask her, you know, about the morality of a woman named Ann Arbor. She'd know that one.
All right, Ted McClellan in studio, 312-981-7200. So tonight, I still like the idea of playing Inspector McClellan.
All right, we'll do that.
So anyone who wants to call up who may live in the different areas, explain again the different areas of the region.
There's the Midland region, which is, you know, that's central Illinois, Iowa, most of Indiana, outside the region. Then there's the Inland North. That's where we are here in Chicago. That goes all the way from Rochester, New York, to Milwaukee. And I, you know, I was playing an example at the last thing I did that kind of proves that we're on the same dialect region, which was in the movie Jackie Brown. You remember Robert Forster as the bail bondsman?
I don't remember what he says.
All right, but if you watch it, he totally sounds like he could be from the south side of Chicago. But he's from Rochester, New York. He's like, this is your bail bondsman, you know. But he's from Rochester, New York. So, I mean, that's sort of the provenance. This is where the Chicago accent originated.
And you got
in Western New York.
There's also the
Minnesota.
And then
there's the North Central accent, the Upper Peninsula, Michigan, and Wisconsin and Minnesota. So I was up there. I was in Rhinelander. I saw all the Hodag statues. I remember we had that one a couple weeks ago. The Hodag, everything's named Hodag. There's like Hodag auto loans in Rhinelander.
and then you told me right before the break that you were able to eat something that
Well, we're gonna ask people I guess later. Well, we can ask people anytime.
We'll ask them anytime.
Yeah, anytime. Or, you know, what is a Juicy Lucy? Call me and tell me, because I had one.
312-981-7200. All right, so but tonight, Ted, let's talk about the Chicago accent, because a lot of times people call in, they said they're from Chicago.
Yeah.
And already the lines are lit up because they say, I got the best Chicago accent.
Right.
But what's the identifiers for Chicago accent?
Well, I guess we're kind of talking about with the classic Chicago accent, and that sort of hit its peak in the city's industrial heyday in the World War II and the baby boomer generations. And, you know, it's substituting D for T. You know, they talk about, you know, these them and those guys.
Right.
And then there's that drawn out O sound, you know, my father. And then there's that raised A, where you say, oh yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. I used to go to the track with a guy from Burbank, and every time I hit a winner, he'd be like, oh, that's awesome. That's awesome.
Dads.
just like that. So, and then, you know, also with the there's the TH sound. You know, the TH sound just disappears.
Right.
So I think I was talking about the anecdote when I was at the bar on the southwest side, and they were saying, oh, what are the squares for this quarter? Zero and tree. That's why we have Troop Street.
Right.
Yeah.
I know, even
the CTA bus guy.
I live on Troop.
Yeah. You live on Troop.
I live on Troop.
And you call it Troop.
I call it Troop.
Even the CTA bus guy calls it Troop.
Well, it's funny because I will, you know, where I live, it's funny because Troop is not how people, if you're not from Chicago or you're familiar with how it's pronounced that way. It becomes Throop, right?
No, well, no, I've never heard it called.
I live on Troop, and they kind of like head nod, like, yeah, that's a weird way to say that word.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. But you're right. Troop is, it's Troop. T-R-O-O-P.
Right. But, you know, the classic Chicago accent is not as common as it used to be. You don't hear it as much in people under 50. It's kind of, there's maybe three aldermen that do it, and they're all from the northwest and the southwest side. So, you know, that's where you're really going to hear
and
it.
And one of them is Alderman Sposato.
Alderman Sposato.
Who,
former firefighter.
Let's see. Do you have that clip, Pete? Let's see if we can hear the former firefighter. Is 36 Ward, I think?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, let's hear Alderman Sposato. It's a Chicago accent.
Also, I've made very few friends. I think it's rather obvious. Most of you here probably follow politics, and I'm somewhat on an island. The only friends I really have is my group in the Progressive Caucus. Eight of us, you know, five pretty strong. The other three are, you know, okay.
Tree,
they disappointed us a little with the budget vote, but that's all right. I mean, they felt, you know, there was a little last-minute deal where the mayor lowered the cigarette tax from 75 cents to 50 cents, and that made three of my colleagues sign off on it. But my main reason for not signing off on it was, and it was a single reason, to tell you the truth, and maybe it should or shouldn't be a single reason why you wouldn't vote for a budget, but it was the whole police thing.
All right.
I have a real problem with paying $93 million a year in overtime, and somebody insulted me by saying this is the right way to do things.
All right, we'll take it. He's got all the elements.
So
that was great.
The classic Chicago accent. So yes, you think you have an accent as good or better?
If you do, I gotta say,
no, we can spot a fake. You know. I don't want Marty Leonard's calling up and doing the regular guy for us here.
312-981-7200. If you can beat Alderman Sposato, we'll give you a Lou Malnati's pizza.
Of course.
All right, Ted McClellan in studio tonight, the author of How to Speak Midwestern. Not only are we want to hear your best Chicago accent, and like you said, we can spot fakes.
Right.
We'll also talk about, you know, we want to guess your accent if you're from one of the regions that Ted's going to lean out. Ted is going to be speaking at the Skokie Public Library coming up on Tuesday, but he's here tonight. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. In studio tonight, Ted McClellan, How to Speak Midwestern. That's his book. He's going to be at the Skokie Library coming up on Tuesday. His last Chicago appearance for a while. That's crazy to think about, man. You've been busy and busy and busy on this book.
Unless some other library wants me to come.
Hey, you here to hear. He's here. Yeah. All right, so we are trying to guess not only your accent, but tonight we're doing a little wrinkle.
Yeah.
The best Chicago accent. We've got people that are lined up. The phones are jammed up. So why don't we start with Lori. Lori, hi, Lori. How you doing?
Hi.
This is Justin. This is Ted. Ted's going to ask you a couple questions to see what we can get out of your Chicago accent.
Hi, Lori. How do you think the Bears are going to do this year?
Zip.
What did she say? What did she say?
She said zip.
Zip.
She's really, really playing that.
All right. All right. How about the Cubs? What about their playoff chances?
Hopeful.
Okay, you're going to do more than one word. You got to give
us a little more.
Yeah.
All right, tell us a little bit about yourself, Lori. What part of town are you from? Where'd you go to high school? What do you do for a living?
High school, Miles West.
Uh-huh.
Part of town, grew up in Chicago, and Highland Park is where I live now.
Okay.
And the type of work would be consulting.
Okay. Well, she said Chicago. That's a point.
Yeah. Why do you think
I know,
you have...
I have a Midwest nasal twang.
Oh, for
but
sure.
But I don't have any of those attributes you're looking for.
Okay.
And I know I pronounce all the words with, like, coffee.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my thing.
All right. Thanks, Lori. Thanks for that. All right. So Lori's in the mix, but let's go to Scott. Scott, you're on with Ted McClellan. Scott, give us your best Chicago accent.
Well, I tell everyone I don't have a Chicago accent. I talk normal. Everybody else talks wrong.
Yeah. Well, what part of town are you from, Scott? Where did you go to high school?
I went to school in the Berwyn-Cicero area.
All right. That's point for you. And what do you do now?
I try to do nothing.
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding.
That's another point for you.
I got three kids, and I got my wife sitting next to me, so... I got to say, I do a lot.
All right. Well, having three kids, that's a third point for you.
Well, that's the other thing.
Yeah.
Every single time that I'm reading something or they'll say the time, what time is it? 3 o'clock.
Yeah.
Three?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, can I say what street you live on?
What street I live on?
No, no. Well, yeah. What street Justin lives on?
Yeah.
T-H-R-O-O-P.
No, he lives on Troop.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
If you said to me you live on, wait a minute, the Roop.
Yeah.
I have to say you don't live in Chicago.
Yeah, you really have to think about that before you say it. Well, what do you think about the Cubs playoff chances? Or are you a White Sox fan? You don't want the Cubs to
go to the playoffs. White Sox. The Cubs, who cares about them? The White Sox.
Yeah. What about the Bears?
The Bears?
Yeah.
I think they're going to do pretty good because I was listening to Rohit Canellis on earlier.
Yeah.
And saying, they're going to do pretty good with this new quarterback. It sounds like, he's got some prospects, some hope rather.
All right. Yeah. Well, I think you definitely have prospects and hope to win that pizza.
All right, Scott. Thank you very much. You're in the lead. I appreciate the call.
So what do I got to do? I got to stay on the phone?
No. Pete will get your number, and at the end we'll pick who won tonight. But you got the lead right now,
yeah,
Scott.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
All right.
Hey, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You too. Ratter did it for me. Ratter. All right. Let's go to Anthony. Anthony, you got to beat Scott off the block on that one. That was a pretty good one.
Yeah.
I don't think I can beat that.
Yeah. No.
That guy's damn good.
Yeah. Well.
So here's the thing. I don't think I have an accent, but I used to work up by Schaumburg.
Yeah.
And I worked with told me I had a thick Chicago accent.
Yeah. Well, where part of town are you from? Where'd you go to high school?
I went down there, Brother Rice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And what do you do now?
I do a couple different things.
He opens a car door.
Yeah, he opens a car door. Yeah.
Yeah, I gotta get a speaker in my car to oil things.
All right. Well, shut the door while you're on the radio,
yeah.
And then
No, the door is shut. It's a sensor.
Oh,
it's the what? The oil is. It's the oil light? Is that what's beeping?
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, wow. All right, well, change your oil and call us back.
Thanks, Anthony.
All right.
All right. Well, I don't know how anyone beats Scott.
No,
at this
I mean
point.
Even Anthony said Scott should win.
Scott, that's pretty good. Yeah. It was Ratter.
Yeah,
when he said Ratter instead of Rather. That was good. All right, good stuff. 312-981.
Scott is the Chicago accent champion.
Well, no, we still got a way to go.
Oh, we got more to go.
Come on, Ted.
Oh,
why you giving away so quick?
I thought you were going to just
no.
Do
the
three.
Lines
I
have lit up.
Just going to do tree.
No, the that would be appropriate, right? To do tree. But no, the lines are lit up to replace. And so while we wait for people before we go to the news, why don't we bring in? Why don't we bring in Paula?
Okay.
And see if we can do Paula because she wants to play Guess the Accent.
All right,
Paula, how you doing, Paula?
Okay, and I'm afraid Scott's eating my pizza.
You're eating your pizza right
Scott's
now?
Scott's eating her
oh,
pizza.
Eating
yeah, he's eating it.
All right, well, Paula, without telling us, do you want to play the game or we guess where you're from, or are you from Chicago?
Well, I'll let you decide because I've had people tell me I'm from all over the place when I'm talking to them, and I would like some official opinion of what you think of whatever accent it is I do or don't have.
Okay.
All right.
Well, a lot of the way we do it is we ask you what you use for certain terms. For example, we'll say, what do you call athletic footwear?
Gym shoes.
All right.
Gym shoes.
See,
okay. So right away.
Yeah. And what do you call the narrow space between two buildings?
Oh, well, that's an alley.
Yeah. Well, it sounds right away you're in Chicago area, right?
Yeah.
Gym shoes gym and
shoes.
An alley.
Yeah.
Say that you got Chicago.
Yeah. What do you call it when
New York doesn't have stuff like that?
No, New York doesn't have alleys. No. They put all their trash out in front of the.
But some people call it gangways.
Some people call it a gangway when you're talking about, you know, not behind the house, but between the houses.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What about when traffic is slowed down because a lot of people are rubbernecking? What do they call that?
Well, I guess it's a traffic jam, isn't it?
Yeah, that's one term for it. Or what do you call it when you put furniture out in the street after you shovel out of space in the winter to make sure nobody parks there?
Mayor Daley's favorite thing.
What's the term for that?
Right. Oh, golly, I think I've forgotten.
Oh, boy.
Well, don't give away. I would say Paula's from Chicago.
Yeah, just the gym shoes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because of the things I know. But does it sound like I'm from Chicago?
I think
definitely,
it does.
Yeah, definitely a Midwestern accent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good to know. I'm glad that I'm home.
Yeah. All right. We're glad
thanks,
that you're,
Paula. Thanks
we're
for
glad you're one of Chicago's very own.
All right. Ted McClellan, How to Speak Midwestern, the book. You can also see him at the Skokie Public Library coming up on Tuesday, 7 o'clock. All right. We'll take a break or we'll get the update on the news with Rob Martyr. And then we come back. Second half. I want either people already on the line, but I want more. I don't think Scott just gets it,
right?
Because he said tree a couple times.
Yeah.
Right?
All right. So we've set a bar, and we got people out there.
So bring it. 312-981-7200.
All right.
Here with Ted McClellan. Thanks, Rob. It is a download here, 720 WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Ted McClellan in studio with us tonight with the segment where we can guess where you're from by how you talk. Tonight we are doing a special segment on the Chicago accent.
Yes.
Ted McClellan, of course, the author of How to Speak Midwestern. He's going to be at the Skokie Public Library coming up on Tuesday, which effectively ends his Chicago. He's been on tour. It seems like every week you've been on tour around the Midwest with this book since it came out in December. So congratulations on that. But
thank you.
But like you said, you'll go anywhere. You'll go to anyone wants to.
Yeah, I went to Westmont, so yeah.
There you go.
I'll go anywhere. I'll go to Westmont. Come on. Sorry, Westmont.
All right, 312-981-7200. So you heard us in the first half talking about the Chicago accent.
Yeah.
And we had Lori call in, Scott, Anthony.
And we got to make a little point here. From the news, I heard WGN has not taken a stand on the pop soda debate. They were just calling it the sweetened beverage tax.
We call it the sweetened beverage tax.
I see in the news that sometimes it's the soda tax. I actually heard the soda tax more, and sometimes I hear pop tax, but it being in Cook County, it should be the pop tax. And I have a little explanation
in
my book about why we call it pop.
Yeah, why do we call it
pop?
All
right, well, on the East Coast, it's soda because they drink out of a soda fountain. In the South, it's Coke because that's where the headquarters of Atlanta is. Coke's headquarters is in Atlanta.
Yeah.
In the Midwest, it's the sound the cork makes when it's drawn out of a bottleneck. Ben and Perry Fagenson, the Detroit bakers who founded Faygo, took note of this and named their strawberry-flavored drink Faygo Red Pop. And MAPS, it became a regional hit, and maps showing the distribution of the word display a nearly perfect overlay with the region we think of as the Midwest. In fact, the line separating soda drinkers from pop drinkers is said to lie between exits 41 and 42 on the New York State Thruway. To the east in Syracuse, they say soda. To the west in Rochester, it's pop. And as I was saying, I went to Target the other day, and it says get soda, add soda for a dollar. And as you mentioned, Target's a Minnesota company,
yeah,
and they say
pop
there. But, you know, they say soda in New York and L.A., so that's kind of become the standard media term. And we got to stop it from invading the Midwest. Yeah. We have to keep it out.
We count on you, President Preckwinkel.
Yes.
Call it the pop
President
tax.
Preckwinkel, you are from St. Paul, Minnesota. You live in Chicago.
Pop tax.
Exactly.
There you go. All right, so let's go back to the Chicago accent. Scott had the winning. I had him down for 6 check marks on my notes. Yeah. I don't know what those check marks mean, but he hit 6 different things in the Chicago accent. Let's go to Joe. Let's start us off with the second half here. Joe, you ready to show off your Chicago accent?
Yes, I am.
All right. So, Ted, what do we
Joe,
think?
Tell us a little bit. Where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to high school? What are your favorite Chicago sports teams and sports memories?
I'm from the southwest side, and I went to Queens.
Okay. Is that Queen of Angels?
Nope, Queen of the Universe.
Queen of the Universe. Okay, that's even bigger. Yep. All right.
I went to St. Lawrence High School.
Okay. That's in Burbank, right?
It is.
Okay. And where do you live now?
Actually, now I live in Park Ridge.
Okay.
So I'm a Northside. But I've always been a Cubs fan.
Mm-hmm.
And what did it for me was WGN, because, you know, I'd come home from Queens, and the Cubs were on WGN. So between that and my half of the family lives on the north side, I guess the north side relatives got to me first. So I've always been a Cubs fan, and boy, did I take heat for it when I was growing up.
Yeah. Well, who are your favorite players?
Ron Santo, Ernie Banks, Don Kessinger, Rick Monday, all of them. Mm. Fergie Jenkins.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and what about now?
It's hard not to like the whole team, man. They're outstanding.
Yeah. So.
But I'm not a Sox hater. Mm-hmm. I'm not a Sox hater at all. I wish them all the luck in the world. And utopia for me would be Cubs and Sox going to the World Series and the Cubs winning it in extra innings in the seventh game.
For you, can I ask a question, Joe? Just when you eat an encased meat, and it's a Polish, what is a Polish what?
Sausage.
Yeah, there you go. Well, Northside, that was
No ketchup on that sausage either.
No.
Yeah, right.
No.
All right.
Absolutely not. Yeah, and you got to run it through the garden.
Right. What are the ingredients? How many of the ingredients can you give us right here on the air?
Oh, you got pickle, you got hot peppers, you got the chopped onions, you got the green relish, and you got the mustard, and then you got the celery salt.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go. All there, right. Point for that. Thanks, Joe. Right. Thanks for calling. All right. So let's see what else we got here. Let's go to Mike. Mike's on the northwest side. All right,
hey,
Mike.
Guys, love the subject. Should I just go right into my field? Because, on the 4th, I took my mother-in-law downtown. She hates the fireworks, okay? So she says, we don't need to be that close. And to boot, I'm trying to park as close as I can. So all day, all these guys are telling me no parking, no parking. I find a guy who points to an alley and goes, over by there, cost you a sawbuck. It'll cost you a sawbuck. Guys are charging $100 for spots like that. All right, you can quiz me on anything in Chicago, guys. I don't know if I need to.
Do you live in Alderman Spazzato's ward by any chance?
I remember Riverview. I don't know if anybody can. I'm dating myself. The flying turn, shoot the shoots. My parents had a bar on. Wabansia and Campbell, west of Bucktown. And I got 3 young sons, and they laugh when I try to tell them about what to do in Chicago.
Did you live above the bar?
Yes, we did.
All right. Yes, we did.
Can Google it. Wabansia and Campbell.
What was the name?
It was the Black Swan.
Okay.
Ooh, the Black Swan.
Yes, and we're Poles, we're Polish, and I go back there now, and it's something that's unrecognizable. But I got pictures. My grandpa Andrew had a picture on Nettie's Duesenberg because he had to buy beer from Kapal.
Oh, great stuff, Mike. Great stuff tonight. You're in the running. I appreciate it. Thanks for the call. That's good stuff, Mike's Mike's that's good, man. This is gonna be tough. Let's go to Nick. Nick's on the south side. Nick, what do you think?
Just the names guys? Tell us. We got great accents. Anthony, yeah. Mike, Nick.
How you guys doing?
Great.
Yeah, listen, what do you guys want me to do? I'm sitting here. That first guy was very, very good.
Yeah.
But I never had one of those pizzas that you had, when you give out. And I'm thinking, I'd give it a shot.
Lou Malnais, what's your favorite pizza in Chicago?
The brand name or what I put on it?
Well, both.
I like... Palermo's, and I like green peppers, easy end of cheese, naturally sausage, and that's about it.
Yeah,
sweet sauce. And what else?
Where are you from? What parish are you from?
I'm Queen of Martyrs on 103rd Street.
All right.
103rd Street.
103rd
wow.
and
103rd and Central Park.
Okay. All right, and where'd you go to high school?
I went to high school that's no longer there. I forgot what they call it, but it was Harrison High School on Marshall Boulevard, right off of California Avenue.
All right.
Okay.
Dang,
all right.
Man.
Where do you live now?
Where do I live? I live right by. I'm on 103rd and Pulaski.
Oh, so you haven't gone very far.
No, I live by the College St. Xavier's.
Okay.
And. Oh. Like I said before, that guy's going to be pretty hard to beat.
I think you're
giving a run for the money.
Yeah. Well, what's the nickname for St. Xavier?
My daughter went there for a couple years, but I forgot what
what would you when you said my daughter
Dad.
Went to? Yeah, exactly. There you go.
That's it.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we're looking for.
Wow.
Well, that's
all right,
good.
Nick, that's pretty good, man.
Yeah,
thank
right.
you for
yeah,
calling
you
in.
You are definitely in the top two.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
All right, this is amazing tonight. 312-981-7200. All right, so I don't know what to say. I think Nick and Scott, that was – you know what got me?
Think about two pizzas.
You know what it got me was that when he was trying to
when
remember –
he said 103rd. That's definitely one.
But when he was trying to remember the Xavier stuff, he went, no, it's Benamon. Like he went, like, and that, to me, that was very – it could be New York, but at the same time, like this idea.
I think he was probably Italian.
Yeah.
So I think it was probably an Italian thing. Yeah.
Yeah, that's just reminds me. Pretty much.
Yeah.
So there you go. 312-981-7200. The lines are just flying in right now.
Yeah.
Let's take one. Let's guess where Kevin's from.
All right.
How about that? Kevin.
Hello.
Line. How you doing, bud?
And I'm doing real good. I was going to tell you guys I was from the way south side of Chicago.
I think so. South of the, you might even be south of Cairo.
Yeah, a little bit.
All right.
Wow.
I don't know if we can do this.
We do Midwestern,
we
but
do
I'm interested.
Midwestern
I'm,
accents,
I'm very intrigued.
But we'll see if we can figure something out from you. I'm trying to when you want a soft drink, what do you ask for?
Soda pop.
Okay.
Ooh,
usually what I say.
Soda pop. Okay, so you go both ways there.
What let me ask
you. Or I'll say a cool drink. Give me a cool drink.
Okay.
Kevin, I mean, we don't, because Ted mostly does Midwestern, you can tell by your accents, you're outside of the Midwest. What should we know? I mean, tell us a little bit about some of the things that you say that you know that only you say from the accent or from the area that you're from.
Oh, like, for example, somebody will say, I'm going over to the store, and somebody, another guy will say, where's the store at? And I'll say, over yonder.
Uh-huh.
Right, yonder.
3 miles yonder way.
Yeah.
Or somebody asked me how I'm doing, I say, oh, I ain't no worse for wear.
Yeah.
But I got that from my dad.
Yeah.
That's good stuff.
Well, I'm guessing just because of WGN, it's like somewhere in the Mississippi Valley or in the Ozarks, like Missouri, Arkansas, Tennessee area.
You're close.
Yeah.
I grew I grew up in Arkansas and now I live in Mississippi.
Awesome. All right. That's so great. Yeah. Kevin, thanks for calling, man. That, over yonder. I'm gonna try to pick that up here in Chicago. That's good.
All right. Thanks for
I'm usually up here a couple times a week. I run out of Memphis up here, freight, turn around and go back.
Oh, you're in Chicago right now?
Well, I'm south of Chicago on my way back to Memphis. I'm down here around Kankakee, just left Chicago.
All right.
All right. Well, if you ever pick up a Chicago accent, give us a call and you may win a pizza.
There you go. Kevin, thanks, and thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
That was great. What a nice little wrinkle for the How to Speak Midwestern segment. All right, 312-981-7200. Let's do this. Let's take our last break, and we will come back, and we will crown a champion tonight for the best Chicago accent. I mean, right now, Nick and Scott, it's pretty close.
Yeah.
But we'll powwow and figure out exactly what we think, who deserves the pizza. Ted McClellan, of course, the author of How to Speak Midwestern. He's going to be at the Skokie Public Library on Tuesday. 7 o'clock start? That's right.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
That's coming up on this Tuesday. We'll continue the conversation, the fun, right after the break. Stay with us. How fun tonight. Ted McClellan here. We're doing our monthly kind of check-in on accents, the Midwestern accents. Of course, Ted's the author of How to Speak Midwestern. This is where we guess where you're from based on how you talk. Tonight, we decided to go special episode on the Chicago accent. And Chicago did not disappoint.
No.
So much so that we even got a guy from Arkansas area calling in as well. Kevin giving us an idea. Earlier in the show, you actually asked about the Juicy Lucy. Elizabeth's on the line. Elizabeth, hey. What's a Juicy Lucy?
Juicy Lucy is a burger that is rare or medium rare. Oh, man. Mayo, tomatoes, lettuce, and grilled onions. And you can't. Well, I'm not a big person. Biting into it is like,
and
cheese.
And what's inside it when you bite into it?
I'm sorry?
What's inside it when you bite into it?
Double cheese.
Yes.
Double cheese.
I ate my first Juicy Lucy at Matt's Bar in Minneapolis last week.
Wow.
Now, tell me where you think I'm from, or where I live, perhaps.
Okay.
Well, are you from Minnesota?
No.
No? All right. Well, we
all right, let's do a quick, okay, we'll do it. All right.
We have to use a few.
Elizabeth, let me ask you one, okay? When you go to the apparatus outside that has water in it, it's the, you know, where you can drink in the public, it's got water, what do you call that thing?
It's a,
you know, I mean, just like, like when you're, what's the best way to say that?
When you're thirsty and you're, you know,
yeah.
You
so you go to the park and there's a public, you know, thing to drink out of.
I got you. Okay.
What do you call that?
It's a,
this is not a stump question.
No, it's just like, you know, I carry a bottle of water. No. Okay. You go and you just take a drink out of the faucet, the fountain.
Okay,
the fountain. Okay, there you go.
All right.
So you don't call it a bubbler?
No.
No.
Okay. When you go to a store to buy alcohol, what do you call it?
Liquor store.
Okay.
Liquor store. Okay. What? Right. Do you know the name of an annual bicycle rally across the state of Iowa?
Not a clue.
Not a clue. Are you? Well, you're definitely not from Iowa, then.
No, I'm definitely not from Iowa. But that was kind of like the question. That was too funny.
Yeah. Do you know?
Okay, I will tell you one thing.
Okay.
Okay. Here's a clue for you.
Okay.
I remember Riverview.
Oh,
right, we'll see if you're from Chicago.
You're from Chicago.
Yes, yeah.
Okay. Well, that's a good. How did you come to know what a Juicy Lucy is?
That is not a fair question.
No? Did you go to Minnesota?
I'm from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And I say Chicago. Okay,
right.
So where does that come from?
Well, that's only people from Chicago say Chicago.
See, but it's Chicago.
Exactly.
And people from the South Side say Chicago.
No, I know people from the South Side who say Chicago, too. The dailies say Chicago.
Oh, do they?
Yeah, the dailies say Chicago. I know a guy from the East Side who said, you know, anybody who doesn't say Chicago sounds like they're not from.
Because you get that Chicago, but then there's some who say Chicago.
I hate that.
Yeah.
And that's something that they see as very traditional.
Exactly. Well, okay, well, since you identified the Juicy Lucy, you win a copy of How to Speak Midwestern.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, there you go.
Much.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Thanks,
I'll tell you one thing. I did go to Catholic schools my whole life. Went to St. Edward's Sunnyside and Lowell.
Okay.
My father was a Chicago firefighter, and he was based at right near where Mayfair Theater, and then they changed it.
Okay.
Elias and Ainsley, I think.
Okay, up on the west side, Mayfair neighborhood.
All right, Elizabeth, I hate to do this. I have to run because we're getting close to the end of the show and Patty's coming up next. So I appreciate the call. Thank you so much for calling in. All right, so now we are down to the big question about the pizzas.
Yeah. Okay, did we get the guys on the line? Or
no,
we did not. We couldn't get them back.
They
all
said,
right.
Oh, they are on the line? Sorry, I don't have the... There we go. Nick and Scott can call back. Because they aren't answering their phones, but that's all right. We don't have time for that. We don't have time for that.
Okay. Well,
let's get into it. So we got the top three. Third place, we both decided.
Right. Was Mike.
Yeah. Mike.
From the Northwest Side.
The Northwest Side. Yeah. He got a couple of checks. We appreciate that.
Although, you know, Alderman Spizzato's from the Northwest Side, but it's hard to beat the Southwest Side.
So second place and first place, we quabbled over this.
Yeah, right? I like Nick and you like Scott. So,
right.
I mean, can we give them both a pizza?
I think we can. I have to check with
Pete. We haven't
given
out any pizzas.
Well, 815 has a great point. He says, Justin, you should give away the prize for the North Side and a prize for the South Side accent. The two separate prizes because the guy from Park Ridge is definitely a Chicago accent, but it's a North Side Chicago accent. And I got whose daughter went to St. Xavier. He's definitely a South Side accent, just like the first guy.
Yeah.
South Side. So you should give away two pizzas. How about that? They're actually saying that the third, a different guy, I think it was Anthony, was the guy from Park Ridge.
Yeah.
But I say I think we do give away two. I think we would give one to Nick and one to Scott.
That's it.
We did it. We did it.
Yes.
We came together, Ted. How about that?
Nothing more.
Well, this was a lot of fun tonight. I have to say, this was a ton of fun to be able to focus specifically on the Chicago accent and get some guys to call in. And also,
also the Arkansas accent.
And the Arkansas accent.
Don't forget that one.
Cherry on top tonight. Ted McClellan is the author of How to Speak Midwestern, a book out, and he joins us monthly here on The Download, which is awesome. And, of course, he's going to be at the Skokie Public Library coming up on Tuesday night. That starts at 7 o'clock in Skokie. And, of course, if you are listening and you have affiliation to your town's library and you want Ted to come, he's done with tour.
Yeah.
Now you're open.
You can get me through my website, edwardmcclellan.com.
All right.
And we have a Facebook page, How to Speak Midwestern.
There you go. You can just have many ways to get a hold of Ted. Ted, thanks so much, man.
Thank you.
Good stuff. All right, that's going to do it tonight here for The Download. Coming up, Patty Vasquez. Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez here on 720 WGN. She's coming up, and she is going to be celebrating her birthday tonight. Very excited to, and also with Representative Anderson on the show, who, as Mike Fouché called out last week, is kind of pulling a Bullworth as he ends his term and is not seeking reelection. He's kind of in a moment. He's a Republican who's telling it like it is. And he'll be on with Patty Vasquez. That'll be great radio coming up here in the 11 o'clock hour.